by Wilbur Smith. Read by Martin Shaw. The boy clutched at the rim of the canvas bucket in which he crouched 60 feet above the deck as the ship went about. Far below in the pre-dawn darkness, the hull throbbed and resonated to a different impulse as the caravelle Lady Edwina swung round and went plunging back into the west. Hal Courtney had greeted the last 65 dawns from the masthead in this manner. "Today the Dutchman will come," he said aloud, and felt the excitement and dread throb beneath his ribs. High above him the stars began to pale, and far below him he could recognize Ned Tyler, the helmsman, holding the ship true, and his own father, stooping over the binnacle to read the new course, the lantern lighting his dark features. His father was a navigator of the Order of the Temple of St. George and the Holy Grail, the successors to the extinct Order of the Knights Templar, attacked and destroyed in 1312 by the King of France, Philippe le Bel, in connivance with his puppet Pope, Clement V of Bordeaux. Their vast fortune confiscated, they were tortured and burned at the stake. However, the Templar mariners, warned by their allies, slipped their moorings in the French harbours and sought the protection of King Edward II of England. Since then, they had opened their lodges in Scotland and England under new names, but with the basic tenets of the order intact. One day, Hal also would glory in the title of Nortonier Knight of the Order of the Temple of St. George and the Holy Grail. And at 17 years of age, his goal was no longer merely a dream. This current was the highway upon which the Dutchmen must make their westings and their landfall, on the mysterious coast that lay veiled out there in the night. This was the gateway through which all must pass who sought to round that wild cape that divided the ocean of the Indies from the southern Atlantic. This was why Sir Francis Courtney, Hal's father, had chosen this position in which to wait for them. Hal's heart tripped as he caught the gleam of a sail a league to the eastwards before he recognized her. It was the Gull of Moray, the other principal vessel in the blockading squadron. She should be lying out of sight below the eastern horizon. Hal called down to the quarter-deck,
"Gull of Moray, hull up to windward!"
Hal looked beyond the Gull of Moray, sweeping the horizon, and made out the two pinnaces, open vessels, with a dozen heavily armed men crowded into each, spread out 15 leagues on each side of the Lady Edwina, part of the net to ensnare the Dutchmen. When not needed, the pinnaces could be broken down and stowed into the Lady Edwina's hold. The full, steely light of day struck as the sun rose from the eastern ocean. Hal looked northwards to the landmass that crouched like a great rock sphinx upon the horizon. Africa! The uncharted land of dragons and other dreadful creatures who ate the flesh of men. Africa! The land of gold and ivory and slaves and other treasures, all waiting for a man bold enough to seek them out. Long hours he had pored over the charts in his father's cabin, had traced the outlines of the mountains of the moon, of lakes and mighty rivers, confidently emblazoned with names such as Khoikhoi, and Kandabar Sofala, and the kingdom of Prester John. But Hal knew that no civilized man had ever travelled into that awesome interior, and wondered what it would be like to be the first to venture there. Prester John particularly intrigued him. This legendary ruler of a vast and powerful Christian empire in the depths of the African continent had existed in European mythology for hundreds of years. As the Lady Edwina on the Gull of Moray came within hailing distance, the crew swarmed into the rigging and lined the bulwarks to shout ribald banter across the water. The Lady Edwina was a ship of 170 tons burden, with an overall length of little more than 70 feet, but she carried a crew of 130 men, if you counted those now manning the two pinnaces. The Gull was not much larger, but with half as many men again on board. When the Gull of Moray was not cruising in the Gare de Course, Angus Cochrane, Earl of Cambrai, also called the Buzzard, rounded out his purse by trading for slaves. The effluvium of decaying corpses, mingled with the waste odour of the living, gave the slave ships a distinctive stench. No amount of scouring could ever rid a slaver of her smell. As the gull crossed upwind, there were howls of exaggerated disgust from the crew of the Lady Edwina. The language bawled back from the gull made Hal grin, and he imagined his father's fury at hearing it. Sir Francis was a devout man who forbade gambling, led prayers twice a day, and exhorted his seamen to gentle and dignified behaviour when they put into port. He lifted his speaking trumpet to his lips.
"Good morrow, my lord!"
Above his plaid the buzzard wore half armour, but his head was bare, his red hair and beard bushed together.
"Jesus love you, Frankie!"
he bellowed back.
"Your station is on the eastern flank."
Anger made Sir Francis short.
"Why have you deserted it?"
"I have little water, and I'm completely out of patience. 65 days are enough for me. There are slaves and gold for the taking along the Sofala coast.
Your commission does not allow you to attack Portuguese shipping."
"Ah, Dutch, Portuguese, or Spanish,"
Cambrai shouted back.
"Their gold shines us prettily. There's no peace beyond the line."
A century and a half ago, in 1493, by papal bull, the line had been drawn down the mid-Atlantic by Pope Alexander VI to divide the world between Portugal and Spain. "No peace beyond the line" became the watchword of the privateer and the corsair. Within the waters of the northern continent, acts of piracy, rapine, and murder were condoned and even applauded when committed beyond the line. Every monarch signed letters of marque that converted his merchantmen to ships of war and sent them out marauding on the newly discovered oceans of the expanding globe. Sir Francis's own letter had been signed by Edward Hyde, the Lord Chancellor of England, in the name of King Charles II. It sanctioned him to hunt down the ships of the Dutch Republic with whom England was at war.
"Once you desert your station, you'll forfeit your rights to claim a share of any prize," Francis called.
But the buzzard turned and issued orders to his helmsman. The gull's top hamper billowed out, and she heeled eagerly to the southeaster. Slowly the ironic cheering of the Lady Edwina's men died away as they realized their forces had been more than halved in a single stroke. Then Sir Francis threw back his head and laughed.
"All the more for us to share,"
he cried, and they laughed with him and cheered. At last a man came aloft to relieve Hal at the lookout, and he began to scramble down the shrouds. He was broad-shouldered and already stood as tall as his father. His hair glistened blue-black in the sunlight. At this age, his beauty was still almost feminine, and some of the men, whose fancy lay in that direction, watched him lasciviously. Hal dropped lightly to the deck, and froze at the sound of an inhuman cry. A tall figure charged down on him, and he ducked. Silver steel flashed over his head. Hal had a glimpse of his adversary's face, black and glistening as he screamed.
"Ned, a blade!"
Hal yelled wildly. Behind him a cutlass slid across the deck towards him. He gathered it up, aimed the point at the eyes of his attacker. They circled each other as each sought an opening. The seamen on the deck came running to form a ring around the swordsmen, their faces alight with the prospect of seeing blood spurt.
"Pluck the cockerel's saucy tail feathers for him, Aboli!"
Aboli stood 5 inches taller than Hal, and his cheeks were adorned with ritual tattoos that gave him a terrifying appearance. Steel rang on steel, and the crowd howled. Sweat greased Hal's cheeks, and his expression crumpled as Aboli drove him back against the mast. He seemed so much younger suddenly, his lips quivering with terror and exhaustion. Then Aboli's blade flew straight through Hal's guard, and the watchers had the blood they craved.
"Another scar for you each time you fight like a woman," Aboli scolded him.
With an expression of exhausted disbelief, Hal wiped the blood from his chin. The tip of his earlobe was neatly split.
"By Satan's teeth," one of the coxswains laughed. "The pretty boy has more blood than he has guts."
At the jibe, a swift transformation came over Hal. From his throat issued a low growl, and he launched himself at the negro. Aboli was driven back, and all the skill that the lad had accumulated over hundreds of hours and days upon the practice deck suddenly coalesced. Aboli looked into the burning eyes, and he knew. that he was in danger of his life. This was not the face of the child who had been his special charge for the last decade, the boy he loved. This was a man who would kill him.
Henry!
Hal started and looked up at his father on the break of the poop.
Avast that tomfoolery! Get you down to my cabin at once!
Hal hugged Abelie as a child hugs his father.
Abelie, I could have killed you.
Abelie chuckled softly.
At last, you have tapped the well of warrior blood. Go now and do your father's bidding.
In his cabin, Sir Francis looked up from his logbook.
Do not look so smug, puppy, he grunted in Latin.
When they were alone, he insisted on speaking the language of the educated and cultivated man.
Recite the law of the sword.
An eye for his eyes, Hal said in Latin, the other for his feet. Sir Francis nodded. What else?
Keep the point high?
The cardinal rule. Keep it aimed at his eyes.
Sir Francis led Hal through the catechism, as he had countless times before.
Now, he said, take up your livy and translate from the top of page 26.
That night, though it was late when Hal made his way along the upper deck, it was still light enough for him to pick his way over the sleeping bodies of the off-duty watch. The night sky was filled with stars, but Hal had no eyes for them. He was exhausted to the point where he reeled on his feet. Hours later, Abelie woke him from a deep sleep.
8 bells in the middle watch, Gundwane.
He used Hal's nickname. In his own language, it meant bush rat. 4 o'clock in the morning. It would be light in an hour. As he hurried to the foot of the mainmast, Hal saw the glow of father's pipe and smelled his tobacco on the sweet night air. When he reached the masthead, Hal looked about him. There was no moon, and, but for the stars, all was dark. His every sense seemed heightened. He could smell the iodine of the sea, the fresh odor of kelp and salt. There was another scent, so fragrant and heady, that he had to stop himself crying aloud in his excitement. With the aroma filling his head, he fled down to the deck below. He ran on bare feet so silently that his father started when Hal touched his arm.
Father, do you not smell it? Spice! The air is full of the perfume of spice!
They moved swiftly down the deck, Ned Tyler, Abelie, and Hal, shaking the off-duty watch awake, cautioning each man to silence. The waiting was over. The Dutchman was out there somewhere close in the darkness. They could all smell his fabulous cargo now. Under one arm, Abelie carried a rolled bundle of coloured silk. He thrust the bundle into Hal's arms.
From your father. You know what to do with them. He says you are to remain at the masthead no matter which way the fight goes. Do you hear me now?
Hal grimaced rebelliously, but dutifully, climbed into the shrouds and set his longbow into the rack. Now there was nothing to do but wait. Then, out of the dying night, rose a tall, bright tower, shining and translucent as an ice-covered alp, a great ship under a mass of gleaming canvas, the long-awaited Dutch galleon. His father's voice floated up to him.
Masthead, break out the colours!
Hal heaved on the signal halyard, and the tricolour of the Dutch Republic streamed out. Within moments, the other banners burst out from the head of the mizzen and the foremast, one emblazoned with the cipher of the United East India Company. The regalia was authentic, captured only 4 months previously.
This standvastig het.
Sir Francis read the galleon's name off her high gilded transom.
The Resolution. A name which we will soon put to the test.
As he spoke, a long, bright plume of smoke spurted from the ship's upper deck, and a few seconds later the boom of the cannon carried across the wind. The cannon in the galleon's guts were training around, but few could cover the Lady Edwina, as she came flying down on the wind, screened by the Dutchman's own high counter.
A marvel that he waited so long to give us a warning shot.
Put up your helm, Master Ned, and lay us under his stern. Down with the colours of the Republic, and let's see those of England. The display of false colours had won them the time they needed to draw in close. A ragged broadside thundered out across the narrowing gap, but most of the shot fell wide. A neat round hole had appeared miraculously in the sail 6 feet above Hal. He flicked his long hair out of his face and peered down at the galleon. The small company of Dutch officers on the quarter-deck were in disarray, but one caught his eye. A tall man in a steel helmet was rallying a company of musketeers. At his bidding, the men ran aft, each carrying a murderer, one of the small guns especially used for repelling boarders. Hal had seen the execution the murderer could wreak at close range. He swiveled the falconet and blew on the slow match in his hand. To reach the stern, the Dutch musketeers must climb the ladder from the quarter-deck to the poop. He aimed at the head of the ladder and pressed the burning tip of the match to the pan. The small cannon jumped and bellowed, and as the smoke cleared, Hal saw that 5 of the musketeers were down. Hal had never before killed a man, and his stomach heaved with a sudden nausea. For a moment he thought he might vomit. The Dutch colonel looked up at him. He lifted his sword and pointed it at Hal's face. Hal knew that he had made a mortal enemy. At that instant the ships came together, and Lady Edwina's culverins thundered in a single hellish chorus. Their muzzles were pressed hard against the galleon's stern, and the carved, gilded woodwork disintegrated in a cloud of smoke. A wild chorus of warlike yells rose from the smoke, and the Lady Edwina's crew poured up into the galleon. Friend and foe were so intermingled that Hal could only watch helplessly as the fight surged back and forth. Within minutes, it was apparent that the crew of the Lady Edwina were heavily outnumbered, and Hal realized that the fight had swung against them. The Dutch colonel was at the head of the counterattack, roaring like a wounded bull. From the back ranks of the boarding party broke a small group of the Lady Edwina's men who had been hanging back from the first. They were led by a weasel of a man, Sam Bowles. Bowles dropped over the rail to the Lady Edwina's deck, followed by 4 others, and the 5 deserters fell with axe and cutlass upon the lines.
"Father! You'll be stranded! Come back! Come back!"
The last grappling line parted with a crack, and the Lady Edwina bore away, leaving the galleon wallowing. Hal launched himself down the shrouds. The galleon was already a cable's length, the sounds of the fighting growing faint on the wind. A fallen seaman was lying in the scupper, his musket beside him still unbred, the match spluttering and smoking in the lock. Hal snatched it up and raced back along the deck. He thrust the gun's gaping muzzle into Sam's belly.
"Back, you craven swine! We're going back!" Hal screamed.
Sam recoiled, and the other seaman backed up behind him. Sam's expression was desperate. Suddenly, he fled like a scared rabbit. He shot down the ladder to the lower deck, and in an instant the others followed him. Hal dropped the musket to the deck and used both hands on the whipstaff. The first pinnace was now nearby, and Hal could see big Daniel Fisher in the bows. His sailors latched onto the trailing grappling lines that Sam and his gang had cut and came swarming up onto the caravel's deck.
"Daniel!"
Hal shouted at him. "I'm going to wear the ship around. We're going back into the fight!" 12 men, fresh and eager, Hal exulted as he put the whipstaff hard alee. The sails filled like thunder, and suddenly she was clawing up into the wind, tearing back to join the fight. There was a flash of white off to leeward, and he saw the gaff sail of the other pinnace ahead. Another 12 fighting men to join the muster, he thought, and headed straight for the tiny vessel. Within seconds, the pinnace had disgorged her men and was on tow behind the Lady Edwina.
"Daniel!"
Hal called.
"Batten down the hatches on the lower decks. We have a cargo of cowards and traitors hiding below."
Not a single head peered down from the rail above as the 2 hulls came together. Daniel and his crew hurled grappling irons over the galleon's rail and immediately stormed up them hand over hand. Only a second behind Daniel, Hal dropped over the rail. The fight was almost over. Some of the Lady Edwina's men were wounded and groaned on the deck. Others, their hands clasped over their heads, yielded to the enemy. A few were still fighting. Sir Francis and Abberley stood at bay below the mainmast, surrounded by howling Dutchmen. Hal started forward.
for Frankie and St. George!
He screamed at the top of his lungs, and Big Daniel took up the cry. The Dutch crew were themselves almost spent. Most flung down their weapons and rushed to hide below decks. The stouter souls swung about to face the charge, those led by the Dutch colonel. But the yells of Hal's boarding party had rallied their exhausted shipmates. The Dutchmen were surrounded. The Dutch colonel, Cornelius Schrouder, whirled to confront Hal. But in order to meet Hal's charge, the colonel had turned his back on Aberley, who rushed at him from behind and brought the steel basket of his cutlass onto the back of the colonel's skull. The Dutchman toppled face down on the deck. The last resistance of the galleon's crew collapsed with him. They threw down their weapons. Sir Francis came striding towards his son, thrusting his way through the milling, cheering pack of his seamen. "You deserted your post," he scowled at Hal.
"Father, I thought..."
"Yes, and for once you thought wisely." Sir Francis's dark expression cracked, and his green eyes sparkled. "We'll make a warrior of you yet." He turned and bellowed across the deck.
"I'm proud of all you rascals. A good day's work. You'll each go home with 50 gold guineas in your pocket. But the Plymouth lasses will never love you as well as I do."
They cheered him, hysterical with the release from desperate action and the fear of defeat and death. "Come on," Sir Francis nodded to Aberley and started for the officers' quarters. Hal followed at a run. His father wanted the Dutch captain's charts, log and sailing directions. With those in his hands, he would have the key to every Dutch harbour and fort in the Indies. He would read the sailing orders of the spice convoys and the manifests of their cargoes. To him, they were worth £10,000 in gold. At the sight of Sir Francis, the galleon's captain froze in the act of stuffing the ship's books into a weighted canvas bag. Aberley grabbed the bag, and Sir Francis made a courteous little bow. "You speak English?"
"No English."
Sir Francis changed smoothly into Dutch. He spoke most of the languages of the great seafaring nations. "You are my prisoner, Mynheer. What is your name?"
"Limburger, captain of the first class in the service of the VOC.
Sir Francis smiled. "As soon as you give me your word, you will be treated as my honored guest. The day your ransom is paid, you will go free." The captain handed his sword, hilt first, to Francis.
"You have my word. I will not attempt to escape."
"I will need your cabin, Mynheer, but I will find you comfortable quarters elsewhere." Cutlass in hand, Hal moved cautiously down the narrow corridor. The first door he tried was locked. He backed off and charged. The door burst open, and he was aware of an aroma more heady than any spice he had ever smelt. At that moment there came a heartbreaking sob from behind a gaudy Chinese screen across one end of the cabin. "Who's there?" Hal stalked towards the screen and stood gaping at the wondrous creature who knelt in the corner of the cabin. The mass of shining hair that tumbled to the deck glowed like gold.
"Mercy," she whispered pitifully in Latin.
Her tears served only to enhance her iridescent violet eyes.
"You are... beautiful," Hal said, also in Latin.
All the worlds of chivalry which he had read and mouthed, but never truly understood, rushed to his tongue, but he could only stand and stare. Then he was distracted by a sound behind him. From under the satin sheets that trailed over the edge of the huge bed crawled a porcine figure.
"Please do not kill me. I am a rich man."
The man sobbed in Latin.
"I will... pay any ransom."
"Get up," Hal prodded him. "Who are you?"
"Petrus van der Velde, the governor of the Cape of Good Hope. This lady is my wife."
Hal stared at the man, aghast.
"My father-in-law is the director of the company, one of the Council of 17. He is one of the richest and most powerful merchants in Amsterdam. He will pay anything. Please do not kill us."
Sir Francis Courtney stood in the entrance to the cabin. "Please calm yourself, Governor. You and your wife are in safe hands." He bent his knee towards Katinka van der Velde. Even he was not entirely proof against her beauty. Sir Francis looked down paternally upon his crew in the galleon's waist.
"I promised you 50 guineas, the man, as your prize," he said, and they cheered him wildly. "I lied to you. There's not a man but is the richer by 200 pounds for this day's work."
They stared incredulously at him, and then they went mad with joy. Sir Francis waved a sheaf of pages over his head, and they fell silent again.
"This is the extract I've made of the ship's manifest."
The recital went on for almost half an hour, for they cheered each item of the bill of lading that he translated from the Dutch as he read aloud. Cochineal and pepper, vanilla and saffron, cloves and cardamom, with a total weight of 42 tons.
"There's also gold and silver in steel chests in the bottom of the main hold, with 300 tons of timber on top of it."
Hal realized that this must be one of the greatest prizes ever taken by English sailors during the course of this war. But he was unable to concentrate on anything but the treasure which he had captured with his own sword, and which now sat demurely behind his father, attended by her elderly maid. Petrus van der Velde stood behind her, his corpulence covered with the silken sashes of his office. Behind the governor were ranked the Dutch captain and the other captured officers.
"But that is not all, lads,"
Sir Francis assured his crew.
"We are fortunate enough to have aboard as our honoured guest the new governor of the Dutch settlement of the Cape of Good Hope. We are also fortunate to have with us the governor's lovely wife."
He broke off as the crew sounded their appreciation of her beauty.
"Mevrouw van der Velde is the only daughter of burgher Hendrik Kurtzer, the chairman of the governing board of the Dutch East India Company. The governor and his wife will be held on board this ship until their ransom is paid. One of the captured Dutch officers, Colonel Schrouder, will be dispatched in the Lady Edwina to the Cape of Good Hope with the ransom demand, and I have set the governor's ransom at 200,000 guilders in gold coin."
The ship's company was stunned. Then Daniel bellowed,
"Let's have a cheer for the captain, lads!"
And they yelled until their voices cracked. Sir Francis walked slowly down the rank of captured Dutch seamen. None had any ransom value, and there was always the danger that they might attempt an insurrection. He addressed them aloud in their own language.
"You have done your duty well. You will be set free and sent back to the fort at the Cape. I will see to it that you are paid the wages owing you before you go."
Their faces brightened. They had not expected that. The Lady Edwina came alongside, and the work of clearing her out began. Stripped to her planks, she rowed high in the water when Colonel Schrouder and the released Dutch crew were ready to board her. Sir Francis handed the colonel back his sword and the letter addressed to the Council of the Dutch East India Company in Amsterdam.
"I hope we meet again, Meneer," Schrouder said.
"Yes, in 8 months from now I'll be at the rendezvous, 33 degrees south latitude and 4 degrees 30 minutes east," Sir Francis assured him. "Then I shall be delighted to see you again, so long as you have the ransom for me."
"You miss my meaning," said Cornelius Schrouder grimly.
"I assure you I do not," responded Sir Francis quietly.
Schrouder dropped over the galleon's side to the deck of the caravel. Immediately the lines were cast off, and the Dutch crew set the sails. From the masthead, Hal watched her until her white sails merged with the tossing manes of the white horses on the horizon.
"She's gone!"
he shouted at the quarter-deck. Sir Francis had waited for this moment before he brought the galleon around.
"Assemble the ship's company," he said to Hal when he reached the deck. "We will ask God's blessing on her, and rename her Resolution."
The crew cheered until they were hoarse. Sir Francis silenced them at last.
"There is one more task we have to perform now. Bring the prisoners on deck, Master Daniel."
Sam Bowles was at the head of the forlorn file that came up from the hold.
"Mercy, Your Grace. It was a madness of the moment. Truly, we repent. Forgive us, we beg you.
Bowles pleaded as their spokesman.
Ah, string him up at the yardarm. Let's watch him dance a little jig to the devil.
Hanging's too good for the swine. Kill all them.
Sir Francis gestured to Big Daniel. Take them down below and let them stew for a day or two. We'll deal with them when we get into port. For the first time, Hal had a cabin of his own.
Well, you, need a lighted place to continue your studies. Sir Francis justified his indulgence.
An oil lamp swung above his head, giving Hal just enough light to write the lessons his father set him. A faint noise came from the luxurious quarters of the governor's wife. He convinced himself that it was Katinka, and her nearness thrilled him. He looked down and saw that a faint ray of candlelight was shining through a crack in the panelling. Without regard to the consequence, he sank to his knees and placed his eye to the crack. He gasped as he caught the pearly gleam of flawless white skin. But at that moment the candle in the other cabin was whisked away. He heard soft footfalls move away, and darkness and silence fell beyond the panelling. He could not remain in his cabin a moment longer. He fled up to the deck and stood for a while at the rail, breathing deeply. He felt steadier and looked about him to take stock of his surroundings. He heard a soft, conspiratorial whispering near at hand. A small group of figures was hiding under the rise of the forecastle. They heaved up an empty cask and flung it over the rail.
"Hey, you men! What are you doing?"
Hal called. After their trial, Sam Bowles and his men had been frog-marched below and thrown into what must have been a carpenter's store.
"Whereabouts are we, below the waterline?" Ed Broom asked miserably. "None of us knows his way about his Dutch hulk,"
Sam grunted, and they lapsed into silence. An hour later, Ed Broom murmured,
"There's air coming in here someplace. I can feel it on my neck."
There was a scrabbling sound, and Sam demanded,
"What are you doing?" "Well, there's a gap in the plank in here. That's where the air's coming in."
"Let me see." Sam crawled across.
"You're right. If we could open her up."
They tore at the opening, ripping out fingernails and driving splinters into the palms of their hands in their haste, until Sam wriggled headfirst into the hold they had made. It was the hold that contained the spice casks, and light came in the gaps where the hatch combing had not been secured.
"Give me a hand here," Sam said,
and the others boosted him up onto one of the casks below the hatch.
"There's naught but a piece of canvas between us and the deck now," he whispered triumphantly. "We'll wait for dark."
Gradually the light dulled and faded. They could hear the ship's bell tolling the watches.
"End of the last dog watch," said Ed. "Let's go." "Nah, give it a while more," Sam urged.
After another hour he nodded.
"Loose those sheets."
They freed a corner of the canvas and Sam peered out.
"All clear. There's empty water casks at the foot of the mast. That'll do us just jack a dandy."
He wriggled out from under the canvas and darted across the deck. The others followed, and within seconds they had two casks free.
"Together now, lads,"
Sam whispered, and they trundled the first across to the rail and flung it over. They ran back for the second as Hal hailed them.
"It's Frankie's whelp,"
one cried. And instantly they all rushed for the rails and dived over. The hull of the galleon trundled majestically past, leaving them in her wake. Sam Bowles struck out overarm, for, unlike most of his fellows, he was a strong swimmer.
"Help me, Sam!"
He recognized Ed Broom's wild cries.
"Give me a hand, shipmate, or I'm done for!"
Sam stopped to tread water, and in the starlight saw the splashes of Ed's struggles. Beyond him he saw something else. The cask. Sam sheered away from Ed Broom.
"Sam, don't leave me!"
Ed's voice was growing fainter. Sam reached the cask and got a handhold on the protruding spigot. Another head bobbed up beside him.
"Who's that?"
he gasped.
"It's me, John Tett."
Sam reached down and loosened the rope belt from around his waist. He used it to take a turn round the spigot and thrust his arm through the loop. Tate grabbed at the loop too. Sam let him be. He could not afford to squander his strength in wrestling with a bigger man. There was no sound or sight of any of the others, and they hung together on the rope in hostile truce. The water was cold and dark, and both men imagined what might be lurking beneath their feet. A pack of monstrous tiger sharks always followed the ship in these latitudes. Sam felt his lower body cringe. The night passed, and as the dawn light strengthened, stupefied with cold and hunger, they hung on to their precarious handhold.
"There's the land,"
Sam whispered, as a swell lifted them high, and they could make out the shoreline of Africa.
"It's so close, you could swim it, easy."
John Tate stared at him sullenly through eyes scalded red and swollen.
"You'll not get rid of me that easy," he grated.
The sun rose higher, and they felt it on their heads, first as a gentle warmth that gave them new strength, and then like the flames of an open furnace that seared their skin and dazzled and blinded them with its reflection of the sea around them. Sam noticed a patch of cloud shadow that passed close by, moving darkly across the surface of the water. Sam lifted his head. There was no cloud in the aching vault of blue sky to cast such a shadow. A swell lifted the cask so high that he could look down upon it.
"Oh, sweet Jesus!" he croaked.
The water was as clear as a glass of gin, and he had seen a great dappled shape move beneath, the dark zebra stripes upon its back. He screamed. John Tate lifted his head. He stared into Sam's wild eyes, and then turned his head to follow their gaze.
"Shark!"
John Tate hissed.
"Tiger!"
He kicked frantically, trying to impose Sam between himself and the creature.
"Shut your mouth! Don't move!"
His sphincter loosened, and immediately the creature's tail beat to a faster rhythm as it tasted his excrement. The shark drove forward until its snout crashed into the side of the cask. Sam watched in terror as the wide lips gaped. The ranks of fangs were thrust forward, fanning open. Both men were screaming incoherently, clawing wildly at the barrel staves and at each other. The shark backed off and started another of these terrible circles. Beneath the staring eye, the mouth was a grinning crescent. Now the thrashing legs of the struggling men gave it a new focus, and it surged on again. John Tate's shriek was cut off abruptly, but his mouth was still wide open, so that Sam looked down his pink, gulping throat. Then he was jerked beneath the surface. As he was pulled under, the cask bobbed and dugged like a cork. Suddenly the cask flew to the surface, John Tate's wrist still twisted into the bite of line. A dark, roseate cloud spread to discolour the surface around them as John's head broke out. He made a harsh, cawing sound, and his face was icy white as his life's blood drained from him. The shark came surging back, and beneath the surface latched onto John's lower body. Sam tugged at John's wrist.
"Get away!"
he screamed at both man and shark. With the strength of a madman, he pulled the loop free and kicked at the other man's chest, pushing him clear. John Tate did not resist. Although his lips writhed, no sound came from them. The shark seized him and swam off, gulping down lumps of his flesh. The damaged cask had taken in water and now floated low, but this gave it a stability that it had lacked. At the third attempt, Sam dragged himself up onto it. He draped both arms and legs over it, and lay unmoving, riding the salty belly of the ocean, rising and falling to her thrusts like an exhausted lover. The night fell over him, and he fell into delirium. He dreamt that it was morning again, that he heard human voices near at hand. He dreamed that when he opened his eyes he saw a tall ship, hove to close alongside, and that a boat was lowered and rowed towards him. Only when he felt rough hands seize his legs did he realize this was no dream. The Resolution edged in towards the land with only a feather of canvas set. A lovely, broad lagoon opened ahead of her, surrounded on all sides by high hills densely forested.
"Elephant Lagoon," Hal exulted at the masthead.
It was over 2 months since last they had sailed from this secret sally-port. As if to justify the name that Sir Francis had given this harbour, there came a clarion blast from the beach below the forest. Hal laughed with pleasure as he picked out four huge grey shapes. In the ship's bows, Aboli raised his hand above his head in salute, and called out in the language that only Hal could understand.
I see you, wise old man. Go in peace, for I am of your totem, and I mean you no harm.
At the sound of his voice, the elephants backed away from the water's edge and headed back into the forest at a shambling run. Hal spent the next 3 nights camped on the beach. His father had placed him in charge of ferrying the cannon ashore and building the stone emplacements to house them, overlooking the narrow entrance to the lagoon. Naturally, Sir Francis had rowed across to approve the sights his son had chosen, but even he could find no fault with Hal's eye for a field of fire that would rake an enemy ship seeking to pass through the heads. On the fourth day, when Hal was rowed back down the lagoon, he saw that the work of repairing the galleon was well in hand.
"Your father has sent for you,"
Aboli greeted Hal, and Hal hurried aft. "You have missed 3 days of your studies while you were ashore," Sir Francis told him. "After your supper this evening, I will rehearse you in the Catechism of the Order." When he reached his tiny cabin, Hal was too weary even to light the oil lamp and dropped to his bunk in a stupor of exhaustion. Then he heard faint sounds of movement from beyond the bulkhead, and miraculously his fatigue cleared. He moved on silent feet to the bulkhead. He knelt and ran his fingers lightly along the joint in the woodwork until he found the plug he had left there. Quietly, he removed it and placed his eye to the spy-hole. A bath was set up in the centre of the deck, a heavy ceramic hip-bath in the Oriental style, and Katinka stood naked facing him. Hal's gaze flew to her breasts. Each would have filled one of his hands. While Zelda, Katinka's maid, poured perfumed oil into the water, Katinka took one of her nipples between thumb and forefinger. She rolled it softly back and forth, and while Hal stared in amazement, it swelled and hardened and darkened. Claws of lust tore at his loins. Zelda looked up and snapped a prim reprimand. Katinka laughed, and with a luxurious sigh, she sank into the hot, perfumed water. Zelda lathered soap on a flannel and gave another instruction. Katinka stood up to allow the old woman to soap down each leg in turn. At last, Zelda shuffled out of the cabin. Katinka stepped from the bath, crossed to the door, and slid the locking bolt into place. Then abruptly and shockingly, her lips were an inch from the opposite side of his peephole, and she hissed viciously in Latin, "You filthy little pirate! When my noble husband finds out that you have been spying on me, he will go to your pirate father, and they will have you flogged. You wanted to take your cock in your hand and pull it." "No!" Hal almost shouted. He felt sick and mortified. "Quiet! If they catch you, it will be the lash." "No, please," he whispered back. "I meant no harm. Please forgive me. I did not mean it." "Then prove your innocence. Show me your cock. Stand up. Pull it here next to the hole, quickly, or I will scream for my husband." Consumed by shame, he lifted the canvas skirt, and his penis jumped out like the springy branch of a sapling. "This thing of yours condemns you. You must be punished. Bring your cock closer." He felt the tip of his distended penis touch the rough wood, and then shockingly cool, soft fingers over the tip. "Stay still!" She heard him groan beyond the panel, as her hand began to fly back and forth along the full length of him. The hot, glutinous spurting against her sensitive breasts was so powerful that it startled her, but she did not pull away. "Do not think that I have forgiven you what you have done to me. Your penitence has only just begun. Understand?" "Yes." His voice was ragged. "You must make a secret opening in this wall so that you can come through to me
and I can punish you more severely, do you understand?
Yes, he panted.
The flat boom of a cannon reverberated across the still waters of the wide bay. It was a general alarm signal, and could only mean that a strange sail was in sight.
Beat to quarters, Master Daniel,
Sir Francis ordered crisply. He turned to Ned Tyler. I want the prisoners taken ashore and placed under your strictest guard. Hal, come with me. 300 feet above the lagoon, looking over the ocean, Hal's sharp eyes picked out 2 ships even before the lookout. Sir Francis stared through his telescope. There are 2 ships, one of them a frigate, Hal told his father. Both are standing in directly towards us. Sir Francis snapped the telescope closed. Come along. At a trot, he led the way back to the longboat.
Master Daniel, row across to the batteries on the far side. Take command there. Do not open fire until I do.
Sir Francis strode along the gun emplacements in the cliff.
At my command, fire on the leading ship. Aim at the waterline.
A ship with all sails set drew into view.
Father!
Hal cried.
It's the Gull of Moray! It's Lord Cambrai!
By God, so it is! How did that butcher know we were here?
Astern of the Gull, the other ship hove into view.
I know that ship also!
Hal shouted on the wind.
The Goddess!
Captain Richard Lister, it is,
Sir Francis agreed.
I feel easier for having him here. He's a good man.
Father! Look in the futtock shrouds. That's how they knew. He led them here. It seems even the sharks couldn't stomach Sam Bowles.
Well, we'd better put on a brave face and go and greet our unexpected guests, said Sir Francis, and went down the beach.
As they rowed back up the lagoon, Sir Francis ordered Daniel to steer directly to the Goddess. Richard Lister was at the entry port to greet him.
Thank ye. I heard the word that you'd taken a prize from the Dutch.
Richard seized his hand.
I curse myself for not having found you at Port Louis.
But how did you fall in with a buzzard?
I looked for you off Cape Agulhas, on the off chance that you were still on station there. That's when I came across him.
Well, it's good to see you, my old friend.
But tell me, do you have any news from home? I fell in with one of His Majesty's frigates. All England was struck by the plague, and men, women, and children died in their tens of thousands, so they couldn't bury them fast enough, and their bodies lay rotting and stinking in the streets.
Sir Francis crossed himself in horror.
And then, while the plague still raged, London was destroyed by a mighty fire.
Was it the Dutch?
No, the fire was started by a baker's oven in Pudding Lane.
But the king is suing for peace. The war might be over at this very moment.
Let us pray most fervently that it is not so. I took that prize barely 3 weeks past. If the war was over then, my capture might be construed as an act of piracy.
Richard Lister pointed.
My Lord Cambrai comes to join us.
Frankie,
the buzzard greeted Sir Francis.
That's a bonny wee galleon we have there, and filled to the gunwales with spice and silver, so I hear.
You should have waited a day or two longer before you deserted station. You might have had a share of her.
But my dear Frankie, I never left my station. I took a short swing into the east to make certain the Duchess went trying to give a slip. I hurried back to you as soon as I could.
Take a deep breath, sir.
Sir Francis laid his hand casually on the hilt of his sword.
That whiff of spice is all the share you'll get from me.
The buzzard gave a huge laugh.
Frankie, come and dine on board my ship this evening, and we can discuss your lad's initiation into the order. I know how much the lad means to you, Frankie.
To us all.
We all want him to become a knight of the order, and here we are, 3 Nortonia knights together, the least number it takes to admit an acolyte to the first degree. When will you find another 3 knights to make up a lodge out here beyond the line?
Sir Francis returned long before the midnight watch from dining with Lord Cambrai. As soon as he was in his cabin, he summoned Hal. "On the coming Sunday, 3 days from now, in the forest," he told his son, "it is arranged. We will open the lodge at moonrise, a little after 2 bells in the second dog watch."
"But the buzzard,"
Hal protested.
"You do not like or trust him. He let us down."
"And yet he was right. We might never have 3 knights gathered together again until we return to England. I must take this opportunity to see you safely ensconced within the order. The good Lord knows there might not be another chance. I have prepared against the day of your initiation." He lifted the lid of his chest. "Here is your uniform. Put it on." When he was dressed, Francis stood back and scrutinized Hal carefully.
"It lacks but one detail," he grunted,
and returned to the chest. From it he brought out a sword, but no ordinary sword. Hal knew it well. It was a Courtney family heirloom, but still its magnificence awed him. He flexed it between his fingers and rejoiced in its spring and temper.
"Have a care," his father warned him. "You can shave with that edge."
Hal returned it to its scabbard. Sir Francis then dismissed him and sat and opened his leather-bound logbook. Hal paused in the doorway.
"Thank you, Father. This sword..."
He touched the sapphire pommel at his side, but could not find words to continue. He backed out and shut the door softly.
"Should you allow the buzzard's men ashore?"
Hal asked his father respectfully.
"Forgive me, Father, but can you trust him that far?"
"Can I stop him without provoking a fight?" Sir Francis answered with another question. "He says he needs water and firewood, and we do not own this land or even this lagoon. How can I forbid him?"
Hal might have protested further, but his father silenced him with a quick frown and turned to greet Lord Cambrai as the keel of his longboat kissed the sands of the beach.
"He sees everything," Hal murmured. "He's come to find out where we stored the spice."
Sir Francis glanced at Hal.
"Abberley is waiting for you."
He nodded to where the black man stood patiently a little further down the beach. Hal watched his father walk away with Cambrai and disappear down a footpath into the forest. Then he ran down to join Abberley.
"I'm ready at last. Let us go."
Abberley set off immediately, trotting along the beach towards the head of the lagoon. Hal fell in beside him. Later, on their way back from a day's hunting wild birds, they came round the point and could look in the bay where the 3 ships lay at anchor. Abberley dropped his burden of dead birds to the sand.
"We will rest here."
They both stared down the lagoon at the Gull of Moray until Hal stirred uneasily.
"What is the buzzard up to now?"
The longboat from the Gull was rowing out from her side to where her anchor cable dipped below the surface of the lagoon. They watched the crew of the small boat latch onto it and work there for several minutes.
"They're screened from the beach, so my father cannot see what they're up to,"
Hal was thinking aloud. As he spoke, the men finished their secretive task and began to row back to the Gull's side. Now Hal could make out that they were laying a second cable over their stern as they went. At that he sprang to his feet in agitation.
"They're setting a spring to their anchor," he explained.
"A spring?"
Abberley looked at him.
"Why would they do that?"
"So that in a few turns of the capstan the buzzard can swing his ship in any direction he chooses."
Abberley stood up beside him, his expression grave.
"That way he can train his broadside cannon on our helpless ship, or sweep our encampment on the beach with grapeshot," he said. "We must hurry back to warn the captain."
Sir Francis listened intently to what Hal was saying, and when his son had finished, he stroked his chin reflectively.
"Well done, my boy. The buzzard is up to his usual tricks. You were right. I was on the beach and couldn't see him set the spring."
"Are you going to order him to remove it, Father?"
Sir Francis smiled and shook his head.
"Better not to let him know we've tumbled to him."
The 3 knights had set up the lodge on the hills above the lagoon.
The altar stood within a circle of stones, a fire burning before it.
Who would enter the lodge of the temple of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail?
Lord Combray thundered. A novice who presents himself for initiation to the mysteries of the temple, Hal replied. Hal stepped into the circle, and a long catechism began, as the starry wheel of the firmament turned slowly overhead, and the flames of the watchfire sank lower. It was after midnight when at last Sir Francis placed his great-grandfather's Neptune sword in Hal's hands. Upon this blade you will confirm the tenets of your faith. These things I believe, Hal began, and I will defend them with my life. I believe there is but one God in Trinity, the Father eternal, Son eternal, and the Holy Ghost eternal.
Amen, chorused the three Nortonian knights.
Then Sir Francis Courtney spoke with his hand firmly set on Hal's brow.
I welcome you into the temple. May you always be true to your vows, to your God, and to yourself.
I have a hold filled with spices enough to buy me a castle and 5,000 acres of the finest land in Wales, said Richard Lister, as he clasped Sir Francis' right hand in his.
A little rest with those I love, and then the wind will summon me again. Perhaps we will meet again on far waters, Francis. Richard, I thank you for your friendship, and for what you have done for my son. I hope one day to welcome both your boys into the temple.
Richard's voice was low as he said, Combray had a proposition for me concerning you, but I liked it not at all. Sleep with one eye open. Minutes later, the goddess's sails filled, and she disappeared through the heads into the open sea. That night, Hal slipped into Katinka's hut and crept to her bed. A small white hand seized his outstretched hand and dragged him in. Much later, Hal fell into a deep sleep. An insistent hand on his bare arm woke him.
What?
He began.
Gundwane, make no noise. Find your clothes and come with me quickly.
Hal rolled gently off the bed, careful not to disturb the woman beside him. Neither spoke again till they had crept out through the gap in the stockade.
What is it, Abuli?
Hal demanded.
Listen.
Then Hal heard it, a faint shout of uncontrolled laughter.
God's wounds!
Hal began to run, Abuli at his side. As they reached the first huts of the encampment, they heard a snatch of slurred song.
The gun pits!
Hal panted, and at that moment saw his father coming towards them.
What's happening?
Sir Francis's sword was in his hand.
I don't know,
Hal said. It comes from the gun pits. Without another word, all three ran on and came together to the first culverin. Hal spotted the small keg on the lip of the pit. One of the gunners was on his hands and knees in front of it, lapping up the liquid that dribbled from the spigot. Hal seized the gunner by his hair.
Where'd you get that rum?
He snarled.
A parting gift from his lordship. A certain keg across from the gulf for us to drink his health and wish him godspeed.
Hal flung the drunken creature from him. They ran down the line of emplacements, and in each found sweetly reeking oaken kegs and inert bodies. Big Daniel came running from the encampment.
I heard the uproar, Captain. What's happened?
The buzzard has plied the gun crews with liquor. It can only mean one thing. Rouse the camp, stand the men to arms.
Softly, mind. As Daniel raced away, Hal heard a faint sound from the dark ship across the still lagoon waters. In the moonlight, the silhouette of the gull began to alter.
"Her guns are out," Sir Francis exclaimed. "Down! Get down!"
Suddenly, the night was lit as if by lightning. An instant later, the tornado of shots swept across the beach. They heard the terrified yells of men awakening into a nightmare, and the sobs, screams, and groans of those cut down. Sir Francis roared an order to those gunners down the line, still sober enough to obey.
"Fire! Open fire! Keep firing as fast as you can!"
Hal shouted for Abuli and Daniel. "Come on!
Bring a match and follow me. As he spoke, Ned Tyler sped out of the forest just ahead, leading five of his seamen. All seemed sober.
Good man, Ned, Hal shouted, but we must hurry.
They charged across the shallow channel between them and the island, heading for the fireboats they had prepared for just such treachery. They dragged three of them down to the water's edge.
Not enough wind.
Daniel looked across at the gull. Hal waded out to where the first devil ship bobbed and lobbed a slow match onto the high pile of cordwood. It flared as the pitch-soaked logs caught fire. Hal grabbed the rope attached to the bows and dragged her out into the channel. Then he swam round to the stern and found a purchase on it. He kicked out with both legs, and the boat moved away. With a few powerful strokes, Aboli reached Hal's side. With both of them swimming it out, the boat moved faster. Hal lifted his head and saw the flotilla of small boats from the gull heading in towards the beach, crowded with seamen, their weapons glinting in the morning light. In all three fireboats, the flames roared into boisterous life. Hal saw Combray leap ashore, swinging his claymore around his head. As he reached the trees, he looked back. Even above the roar of the flames, Hal heard him.
Back! Back to the gull! The bastards are sending fireships at her!
Hal felt the ship's bows thump heavily into the gull's stern timbers. He tied her securely on them, and then swam for the shore. The flames licked along the gull's side. Fire was the terror of all seamen. The ship was stuffed with explosives. The faces of the longboat's crew contorted with terror as they followed the buzzard up to the deck.
Buckets! He roared. 10 men on the pumps! Spray the flames!
They scurried to obey, but the fire was spreading swiftly. Aboli and Hal raced into the forest. Sir Francis had gathered around him the Resolution survivors.
Take Aboli with you, and load another culver in. Bring the gull under fire.
Daniel had secured his fireship to the gull's side, and was swimming back to the beach. But the gull's crew had snared Ned's fireship, and were dragging it clear. Ned and his three fellows were also floundering back towards the shore. Hal's culverin bellowed deafeningly, and his men shouted with delight as the full charge of grape smashed into the longboat towing Ned's abandoned craft. The buzzard had at last got his pumps working, and white jets of water were spurting at the flames. Hal's next shot shattered the wooden rail of the gull's larboard side, and went on to sweep through the gangs serving the bow pump. The jet of water shriveled away. Flames had reached the gull's mizzen yards and were taking hold in the furled courses. The buzzard, an axe in his hand, stood over the anchor rope, and with one gigantic swing he cut it free. He bellowed an order to his seamen, who were clambering up the shrouds. They shook out the mainsail, and the ship responded quickly. As she caught the rising breeze, the flames poured outwards, and the firefighters were able to run forward and direct the water from the hoses onto the base of the fire. Still streaming smoke and flame behind her, the gull headed for the open sea.
"We have given his lordship a lesson he'll long remember," Hal exulted. "I doubt we'll be having any more trouble from him for a while."
"The wounded lion is the most dangerous," Aboli grunted. "We have blunted his teeth, but he still has his claws."
Hal and Katinka had found a secret place to meet. It was well hidden, but close enough to the camp. It was not really a cave, but an overhang where the soft red sandstone had been eroded to form a deep veranda. They were not the first to have passed this way. There were old ashes in the stone hearth against the back wall of the shelter, and one wall was covered with a wild and exuberant cavalcade of paintings. Horned antelope and gazelle that Hal did not recognize streamed in great herds across the smooth rock face, hunted by stick-like human archers with swollen buttocks and incongruously erect sexual members. The paintings were childlike and colourful, the perspective and the relative size of the men and beasts fantastical. Hal was enchanted by them. Often in the intervals of quiet between wild bouts of lovemaking, he would lie staring up at these strange little men. He felt a strange longing to know more about the artists and those heroic little hunters and warriors they had depicted. Today the paintings could hold his interest for only a moment, for Katinka's fingers were busy. She laughed throatily.
"There now,
The bigger he grows, the more I love him. But as she pushed her face into the dark bush of his pubic hair, a sound broke in 100 booming echoes from the hills.
Thunder!
Katinka cried.
I hate thunder.
Not thunder. Hal sprang to his feet. Naked, he rushed to the entrance of the cave and stared out. The entrance was high enough to enable him to see over the forest trees surrounding the lagoon. A soft, rolling bank of mist obscured half the lagoon. It blanketed the rocky cliffs of the heads in silvery blue billows that were suddenly shot through with strange, flickering lights. But this was not mist. The thunder broke again. The swirling clouds thickened, spilling densely and heavily as oil across the water. Above this cloud bank, the tall masts and sails of two great ships floated as though suspended. He stared at them, stupefied. Another broadside broke from the leading ship. The tricolour of the Dutch Republic rippled in the light noon breeze. In line behind her, the Gull of Moray followed daintily.
"Merciful God!" Hal cried. "Why do not the batteries return their fire?"
Then he saw strange soldiers in green uniforms overrunning the gun emplacements, their swords flashing in the sunlight.
"The buzzard has allied himself to the Dutch and led them to us!"
His voice trembled with outrage.
"He will pay with his blood for this day, I swear it!"
Hal ran back, pulled on his clothes, and belted on the Neptune sword. "You will be safe here if you stay until it's over," he told Katinka, and started down, oblivious to all but the need to take up his neglected duties, and almost ran into the soldiers moving through the trees ahead of him. Just in time, he smelt the smoke of their burning match and rolled behind the trunk of a wild fig tree. He peered out from behind it and saw that the green-clad ranks were advancing on the encampment under the direction of a white officer. Hal had a moment's respite to think. "I must reach the camp to warn my father, but there is not enough time to find a way round. I will have to fight my way through the enemy ranks." He drew the sword from its scabbard and crept forward. He almost tripped with the shock of seeing Colonel Cornelius Scrowder racing through the trees to head him off. Hal put on a burst of speed, and within 30 flying paces had forged ahead to see the stockade of the encampment through the trees. It was deserted, and he realized that every man would have been decoyed to the lagoon's edge by the heavy fire of the two warships.
"To arms!"
he screamed as he ran.
"Rally to me! The Resolution! In your rear!"
As he burst into camp, he saw with huge relief Big Daniel and a dozen seamen responding to his call. Immediately, Hal rounded on the Dutchman. "Come then," he said, and went on guard. But Scrowder came up short as he saw the Resolution's men bearing down on him. He bounded back into the forest to rally his musketeers.
"Master Daniel," Hal panted, "we are outgunned in the front and outnumbered in the rear. Back to the beach."
Ball and shot kicked up spurts of damp earth at their feet, speeding them on their way. Seconds later, howling grape shot swept over them. Whole trees crashed down, and at his side Daniel gasped,
"Ah! I'm struck!"
and sat down heavily. Hal stooped to aid Daniel, but the big bosun growled,
"Ah, don't dither here, you fool! Run! We're beaten!"
All around them, the Resolution's men, who were still on their feet, broke and scattered.
"Help me, Abily!"
Hal shouted, and Abily grabbed Daniel's other arm. Between them, they hauled him to his feet. They reached a gun pit and pulled Daniel down into it.
"Oh, sweet Mary," Hal whispered.
His face was pale with horror at what he beheld over the parapet.
"Look at those bloody butchers!"
As the green jackets came clamouring forward, they paused to stab and hack the wounded seaman who lay in their path. Sir Francis came dodging down the line and jumped into the pit beside his son.
"We're beaten, father," Hal said. "We must try to get away."
"Where to?" Sir Francis asked with a grim smile. "That way?" And he pointed through the trees towards the lagoon. Both the frigate and the gull had lowered their boats, which were crowded with men, their cutlasses drawn, shouting and cheering as wildly as the green jackets in front.
"And we cannot hope for quarter. Look what those bloodthirsty heathens do to those who try to yield to them. One more cheer for King Charles, we'll go down fighting. The voices of his tiny band were small and hoarse with exhaustion as they dragged themselves over the parapet to meet the charge of 200 fresh and eager musketeers. Hal killed a corporal with a single neat thrust into his throat, then glanced at Aberley. They could hear wild cries in their rear as newly landed enemy seamen swept over the gun pits.
"Farewell, old friend," Aberley panted. "They were good times. Would they had lasted longer."
Hal had no chance to reply, for at that moment a hoarse voice said in English,
"Hal Courtney, your luck has just this moment ended."
Cornelius Scrowder strode forward to face Hal.
"You and me,"
he shouted, and came in fast. The Toledo steel of Hal's blade rang shrilly under Scrowder's mighty blows, and he felt despair as he realized that he could not hope to hold out against such force. Scrowder's eyes were blue, cold, and merciless. He anticipated each of Hal's moves, beating his blade aside, then coming on mercilessly. Aberley had only the stump of a pike shaft in his hand, no weapon to take on a man like Cornelius Scrowder. He saw Hal, his immature strength spent, wilting visibly, and knew by Scrowder's expression when he gathered himself to make the kill. Faster even than Scrowder could send home his final thrust, Aberley darted up behind Hal and struck him down with a crack over his ear. Then he dropped his shattered pike shaft and stood over Hal's inert body.
"You cannot kill a fallen man, Colonel, not on the honor of a Dutch officer."
"You black snipen! If I can't kill a puppy, at least I can kill you."
"I am unarmed," Aberley said softly.
"Ha! I would spare an unarmed Christian, but you are a godless animal."
He drew back his blade and aimed the point at the center of Aberley's chest, but Sir Francis Courtney stepped lightly in front of him.
"On the other hand, Colonel Scrowder, I am a Christian gentleman, and I yield myself and my men to your grace."
He reversed his own sword and proffered the hilt to Scrowder. Speechless with fury and frustration, the colonel made no move to accept Sir Francis's sword, but placed the point of his weapon on the other man's throat.
"Stand aside, or by God, I'll cut you down, Christian or heathen."
A hail made him hesitate.
"Come now, Colonel, I'm loath to interfere, but if you murder the brother of my bosom, Frankie Courtney, then who will lead us to the treasure from your fine galleon, the Standvastighet?"
Crowder's gaze flicked to the face of Cambrai as he came striding towards them, his great blood-streaked claymore in his hand.
"The cargo?"
Scrowder demanded.
"We have captured this pirate's nest. We will find the treasure is here."
"Now don't you be so certain of that."
The buzzard wagged his red beard sadly.
"If I know my dear brother in Christ, he'll have squiddled the best part of it away somewhere." "No, Colonel, you're going to have to keep him alive. Half of what he stole is mine, after all. That was our agreement, Colonel. The reason I led you here."
When Hal recovered consciousness, he saw that a pitiful few of the Resolution's crew had survived. They were guarded by green jackets with loaded muskets. Daniel was sitting up, although clearly he had lost a great deal of blood. The buzzard and the colonel came up.
"Captain Courtney," Scrowder addressed Sir Francis ominously, "I am arresting you and your crew for piracy on the high seas. You will be taken to Good Hope to stand trial."
"I protest, sir." Sir Francis stood up with dignity. "I demand that you treat my men with the consideration due to prisoners of war."
"There is no war, Captain," Scrowder told him icily. "Hostilities between the Republic of Holland and Great Britain ceased some months ago."
Sir Francis stared at him aghast.
I was unaware that a peace had been concluded, he said at last. I acted in good faith, and I was sailing under a commission from His Britannic Majesty. Will you consider me presumptuous if I insist on having sight of the document? Scrowder asked. My commission is in my sea chest in my hut. If you will allow me, I will bring it to you. Oh, no, don't discommode yourself, Frankie. The buzzard clapped him on the shoulder. I'll fetch it for you. He strode away and ducked into the hut that Sir Francis had indicated. Scrowder rounded on him again. Where are you holding your hostages, sir? Governor van der Velde and his poor wife. Where are they? Well, the governor must be still in his stockade with the other hostages. Hal stood up shakily. The governor's wife has taken refuge from the fighting in a cave on the hillside. I led her there myself. Hal avoided his father's stern eye. The buzzard swaggered out of the hut. He carried a roll of parchment tied with a scarlet ribbon, but before he reached them, the buzzard paused and unrolled the parchment. With a jerk of his head, he summoned one of his seamen. He took the loaded pistol from the man's hand and blew upon the burning match in the lock. He grinned at Sir Francis and applied the flame to the foot of the document. By God, Cambrai, you treacherous bastard! Sir Francis started forward, but the tip of Scrowder's blade lay on his chest. For your own sake, do not try my patience any further, sir. That swine is burning my commission. I can see nothing, Scrowder told him. Nothing, except a notorious pirate standing with the blood of innocent men warm and wet on his hands. Cambrai dropped the last blackened shred of the document to the earth, and then he came up to Scrowder. I'm afraid Frankie's up to his tricks again. I can find no letter of mark. Yes, I suspected as such. I place the prisoners in your charge, my Lord Cambrai. I must see to the welfare of the hostages. He glanced at Hal. You will take me immediately to the place where you left the governor's wife. He looked round at his sergeant. Bind his hands behind his back and put a rope around his neck. Lead him on a leash like the mangy puppy he is. By the time they came out on the terrace in front of the cave, Hal was a sorry object. His face was blackened with dirt and gun smoke, and his clothing smeared with blood diluted with his own sweat. Scrowder called out, Mevrouw van der Velde, madam, you are safe. It is Colonel Scrowder, come to rescue you. The vines veiling the entrance to the cave rustled softly, and Katinka stepped out timidly from behind them. Her huge violet eyes were brimming with tears, and her face was pale and tragic, adding to her appeal. Oh! She choked with emotion. Then, dramatically, she held out both hands to Cornelius Scrowder. You came! She flew to him and stood on tiptoe to fling both her slim arms around his neck. I knew you would come. I knew you would never leave me to be humiliated and molested by these dreadful criminals. For one moment, Scrowder was taken aback by her embrace. Then he folded her in his arms. If you have suffered the slightest affront, I swear I will avenge it a hundredfold. My ordeal has been too terrible to relate, she whimpered. This one? Scrowder looked at Hal and demanded, Was he one of those who mistreated you? Katinka looked sideways at Hal, her eyes narrowed viciously, and a small sadistic smile twisted her luscious lips. He was the worst of all. I cannot bring myself to tell you how, what disgusting things he said to me, or how he has harassed and humiliated me. Her voice broke. I can only thank God for the strength that he gave me to hold out against that man's importunity. Hal knew in his heart that she was forced to reject him now in front of this man, and even in his hurt he forgave her. Scrowder's punch caught Hal in the pit of his stomach, doubling him over. How dare you insult and mistreat a highborn lady?
Strouder was shaking with fury. He had lost all control. Strouder's next blow knocked Hal's legs out from under him. He collapsed, and Strouder set on him using both feet, his boots thumping into Hal's curled-up body.
"Oh, yes!"
Katinka trilled with excitement.
"Punish him for what he has done to me. Make him suffer, as I was made to do."
With an obvious effort, Strouder curbed his temper and stepped back, breathing heavily. "That is just a small taste of what is in store for him. Believe me, Mafru, he will be paid out in full when we reach Good Hope."
There were only 26 survivors from the Resolution. Among these were 4 ex-slaves, of which Abelie was one. Nearly all the survivors were at least lightly wounded, but 4, including Daniel, were gravely injured. It was after midnight before Strouder strode out of the darkness and went directly to where Sir Francis lay chained with the others.
"Abelie,"
Hal whispered.
"The sword."
On Strouder's sword belt hung the Neptune sword of Hal's knighthood. Abelie said softly,
"The spoils of war, Gondwani, but at least a real warrior still wears it."
Strouder said to Sir Francis,
"Ezru are well aware.
There is still a large part of the galleon's cargo missing. More than half the coin and all of the gold bullion. Lord Cambrai believes you have hidden the missing treasure."
"Lord Cambrai is a famous liar and cheat," Sir Francis said. "And you, sir, are mistaken in your belief."
Scrowder's face stiffened.
"I have tried to help you, and regret that you reject my offer. However, I do not have the stomach to put you to the question under torture. I will simply do my duty and deliver you to the mercy of the tribunal. You and your men will be taken aboard the Gull of Moray as soon as she is ready to sail tomorrow morning. The Standvasticate will remain here under Captain Limburger to take on her cargo before she resumes her interrupted voyage to Amsterdam."
The slave trains that bound them allowed little freedom of movement, and it was a clumsy line of men that shambled down the Gull's companion ladder under the command of a grinning Sam Bowles. In the depths of the hull stretched the low slave deck. When he lifted the hatch that opened into it, the stench that rose to greet them made even Bowles recoil. It was the essence of the suffering of hundreds of doomed souls who had languished there. The headspace was no higher than a man's waist, so they were forced to crawl down it and drag the wounded men with them. Sam and his 4 mates crawled down after them and shackled their chains into the ring bolts. When they had finished, the captives were laid out like herrings in a barrel, side by side, secured at wrist and ankle, only just able to sit up, but unable to turn or to move their limbs more than a few inches. When the last man had been secured, Sam crawled back to the hatch and smirked down at them.
10 days to Good Hope with this wind. 1 pint of water a day for each man and 3 ounces of biscuit, when I remember to bring it to you. You're free to shit and piss where you lie. I'll see you at Good Hope, my lovelies.
Slowly, the passage of time lost all significance, and none were sure whether it was night or day. Often, as Hal lay in the stupor of despair, the scampering grey rats, big as rabbits, clambered over his body, their sharp claws raising painful scratches across his bare skin. Every once in a while, Hal heard the sputtering release as one of the men voided where he lay, and immediately afterwards came the fetid stench of fresh feces. And when Daniel, beside him, emptied his bladder, the warm liquid spread to flood the planks under Hal and soaked into his shirt and breeches. By the time the Gull anchored off the foreshore in Table Bay, one more of Sir Francis's seamen had died in his chains, and the remaining prisoners were so weak that they had to crawl like animals up the ladder to the upper deck. They huddled there, their ragged clothing crusted with their own filth, trying to shield their eyes from the brilliant morning sunshine. the fabled flat-topped mountain dwarfed and rendered inconsequential the buildings that spread like an irritating rash along the shore above the snowy beach. As the governor's feet touched African soil, the first cannon shot of a salute of 14 rang out. Governor Kleinhans, overjoyed that his successor had at last arrived, was at the foreshore to meet him. The state carriage was waiting, 6 beautiful greys in the traces. Hal squatted in the rank of captives and watched as Katinka was ushered into the carriage. He felt his heart tear with love for her, and he whispered to Daniel and Abberly, "Is she not the most beautiful lady in the world? Now that her husband has full powers, she will persuade him to treat us justly." The two big men exchanged a glance. Having seen the state carriage safely through the gates of the fort, the crowds poured back to the waterfront to have a little sport with the prisoners. Their laughter was unrestrained, their comments ribald. "I'm saving my guilders. I'll not be bidding when that lot go up on the slave block. They don't sell pirates, they burn them. There's Stadiger Jan over there, come to look them over. I'll warrant he'll have a few lessons to teach these corsairs." Hal turned his head to where a tall burgher in dark, drab clothing and a Puritan hat stood ahead above the crowd. He looked at Hal with expressionless yellow eyes.
"What do you think of those beauties, Stadiger Jan? Will you be able to get them to sing a pretty tune for us?"
Hal sensed the repulsion and fascination this man held for those around him, and instinctively knew that this was the executioner. He felt his flesh crawl. "Why do you think they call him Slow John?" he asked Abberly.
"Let us hope we never have to find out."
At the rear of the crowd were those men and women who Hal guessed must be the domestic slaves of burghers. They ranged in colour from the anthracite black of Africa to the amber and gold skins of the Orient, and there was no sound of laughter among them. Just before they entered the fort, Hal noticed one girl in particular. She had climbed up on a pile of masonry blocks for a better view, and she was more beautiful than he had ever expected any woman to be, a flower of a girl, with thick, glossy black hair and dark eyes that seemed too large for her delicate oval face. For one moment their eyes met, and it seemed to Hal that she tried to pass him some message that he was unable to grasp. Then he lost sight of her, as they were marched into the courtyard of the fort where a military armourer struck off their shackles. Hal looked around. The fortress had been designed on a substantial scale. However, the work was less than half finished, and the walls swarmed with hundreds of workmen, and the courtyard was piled with building timber and blocks of dressed masonry. As dangerous captives, they were kept apart from the other prisoners in cells below the south wall, where even on such a sunny day the temperature made them shiver. At the foot of the first flight of stairs, Sir Francis Courtney was thrust into a cell just large enough to hold one man. It was in a row of half a dozen or so identical cells, whose doors were of solid timber. The rest of the prisoners were herded down to the next level and shoved into a long, narrow cell. There were 4 small windows set in the top of one wall, and Abberly hoisted Hal onto his shoulders to reach one of these. He found that his eyes were a foot or so above ground level, and that he had a view of part of the courtyard. He could see the entrance gateway and the grand portals of what he guessed must be the company offices and the governor's suite. Hal lowered himself and pushed his way through the seamen to the door grill.
"Father," he called, "do you have any orders for us?"
"I expect they'll leave us in peace for a day or two.
Tell the men to be of good heart."
A strange voice intervened, speaking English with an unfamiliar accent.
"Are you the English pirates we have heard so much about?"
"We are honest sailors, falsely accused," Sir Francis shouted.
"Who and what are you?"
"I am your neighbour in the Skellum's Den, 2 cells down from you. I am condemned to die as you are."
"We are not yet condemned," Sir Francis protested.
"It is only a matter of time."
"What is your name?"
Hal joined in the exchange.
"What is your crime?"
I am Althuda, and my crime is that I strive to be free, and to set other men free. I led a revolt of the company's slaves. Some were recaptured. Those Stadegayan burned alive. But most of us escaped into the mountains. They sent soldiers after us, but we fought and drove them off, and they could not enslave us again. His was a vital young voice, and Hal found himself drawn to this Althuda. Then how is it that you're back here? I came back to rescue a slave who was left behind. When I entered the colony again, I was recognized and betrayed. A woman? The voice asked. Did you come back for a woman? Yes. Was she your sweetheart? No, Althuda answered. I came back for my little sister.
It was a sparkling autumn day, and Katinka sat in the carriage beside Governor Kleinhans. Cornelius Crowder sat opposite her. She had left her husband in his office, laboring over his report to the 17, and now she felt the devil in her. Almost a mile beyond the forbidding pile of the castle, the governor's residence stood at the mountain end of the company gardens. Even from a distance, Katinka was delighted with her new home. The carriage rolled to a standstill, and her two escorts hastened to help Katinka to earth. At a prearranged signal, all the waiting manservants lifted their hats and bowed low, while the females dropped into deep curtsies. Kleinhans introduced each in turn to her, and one or two caught and held her attention.
"This is the head gardener, a man of some importance in our community," Kleinhans said. "Not only is he responsible for these beautiful surroundings, he's also the official executioner."
Katinka looked up into his strange, pale eyes, imagining what dread sights they had seen.
"They call you Stadegayan?"
"Yeah, Mithru."
"Why?"
"Because I never rush. Because I am thorough. Because plants grow slowly and fruitfully under my hands. Because men die slowly and painfully under these same hands."
His voice was sonorous, yet melodious. She found herself swallowing hard with a strange, perverse arousal.
"We must talk again, Stadegayan," she said huskily. "I'm sure you have many amusing stories to tell me."
Katinka passed on.
"This is my housekeeper," Kleinhans said.
Katinka's eyes widened.
"Her name is Sukina."
Katinka found this woman as enthralling as the executioner. She was so exquisitely small and dainty. The girl wore a high collar, but the stuff of her blouse was sheer and light as gossamer. Like the rest of her, her breasts were tiny but perfect. Sukina's gaze smouldered like the lavas of the volcanoes of her native Bali. Katinka felt herself challenged and aroused. To subdue her and have her, and then to break her. She felt her pulse quicken.
"Follow me, Sukina," she commanded. "I want you to show me the house."
Sukina fell in dutifully behind the golden lady, who, she sensed, already held her destiny in those slim white hands.
"I will wrest it from her," Sukina vowed. "This vile old man could not own me, neither will this golden tiger woman. I swear it."
At last Governor Kleinhans led them across the lawns to where a small gazebo stood. An alfresco repast had been laid for them, and Sukina stood in close attendance. They looked down towards the bay, where the Standvastighet lay at anchor, not far from the Gull of Moray. The galleon had come in during the night, fully laden with her cargo of recovered spices and timber, and she would carry Kleinhans on the next leg of her voyage, so he was in haste to settle his affairs here in the Cape.
"I wish to sell 15 of my slaves," he told Katinka. 5 of the females are pregnant, so already the buyer will be assured of an increase on his or her investment."
"Tell me about Sukina," she commanded. "Was her father a Dutch?"
Although Sukina stood close by, Katinka spoke about the girl as though she were an inanimate object.
"You are observant, mevrouw,"
Kleinhans inclined his head, but no, he was an English trader, and her mother was a Balinese.
So, if her father was English, does she speak that language?
Indeed, she speaks it with great fluency, but that is not all. She has a way with guilders and runs the household with great efficiency. She has knowledge of Oriental medicines and remedies for all illness.
A paragon!
Katinka interrupted his recital.
Her father, this Englishman, what happened to him?
If he loved his concubine, why did he allow her children to be sold on the slave block?
Yeah, he was one of the English bandits who were executed while I was governor of Batavia.
The man's obstinacy was extraordinary. To endorse the punishment, I ordered that the condemned man's concubine be made to watch the execution, she and the two children.
What happened to the woman? Was she sold into slavery with the children?
No. Ashereth threw herself into the flames and perished on the same pyre as her English lover. There was a long silence, and when a cloud passed over the day seemed suddenly dark and chill.
I will take her, Katinka said softly. This girl, Sukina. I will buy her from you.
Hal hung on the grating of the cell window and called his sightings to Abele, who held him on his shoulders.
They've returned in the governor's carriage. Kleinhans, Schrauder, and Governor Vanderfelder's wife. They're going up the staircase. Wait! There's someone else alighting from the carriage. A woman!
At that moment, Hal recognized her as the slave girl who had stood in the crowd.
She's small and young, Balinese perhaps, almost certainly a slave.
Daniel at the grill gate passed this on, and suddenly Althuda's voice came down to them.
Is she very pretty? Does she wear a green jade ornament at her throat?
All those things, Hal shouted, except that she is not pretty, she is lovely beyond the telling of it. Who is she?
Sukina.
She is my little sister.
On their eighth morning in the castle, the iron door at the head of the stairs was thrown open with a crash, and Sergeant of the Jail Mansia bellowed down the well.
Two at a time, form up, we're taking you out to wash the stink off you, or the judge will suffocate. Come now, shake yourselves.
The following morning, they were turned out again, and this time the castle armourer was waiting to shackle them. When the iron-studded door to Sir Francis's cell was opened, Hal pushed himself forward so that they were shackled together.
How are you, father?
I'm well enough. For what has to be done?
In the middle of the morning, they were marched into the main hall of the castle and led to four rows of low wooden benches in the centre of the floor. Their guards with drawn swords lined up behind them. Before them was a heavy table and a tall chair of dark teak, the judge's throne. At one end of the table was a stool, on which the court writer was already seated. At one of another pair of tables and chairs sat someone Hal had seen many times before through the cell window. According to Althuda, he was a junior clerk in the company's administration, Jacobus Hupp. At the second table sat Colonel Cornelius Schrauder, a glitter with his medallions and stars and the wide sash across one shoulder. There was a sudden uproar at the main doors, and crowds from the town burst in and scrambled to find seats. Now the hall was clamorous with excited comment. There was further hubbub as the dignitaries filed out through the doors of the audience chamber. Governor Kleinhans led them, with Katinka van der Velde on his arm, followed by Lord Combray and Captain Limburger. They took their seats, and Hal stared, willing Katinka to look in his direction, but she never as much as glanced at the ranks of English seamen. Colonel Schrauder came to his feet.
This tribunal is convened by virtue of the power conferred upon the Honourable Dutch East India Company, pray silence, and stand for the President, His Excellency Governor Petrus Vanderfelder.
The spectators came to their feet, and some of the prisoners struggled up, but when they saw Francis Courtney and Hal sit unmoving, they subsided. The president glared.
"Get those rogues on their feet!" he bellowed.
Sir Francis spoke out clearly in Dutch.
Neither I, nor any of my men, recognize the authority of this assembly, nor do we accept the right of the self-appointed president to examine and sentence free-born Englishmen.
Van der Velde seemed to swell.
You are a pirate, and a murderer. I find you guilty of contempt of this court, and I sentence you to 10 strokes of the cane. Master of arms, take the prisoner into the courtyard and carry out the sentence.
4 soldiers hurried forward from the back of the hall and hauled Sir Francis to his feet. Hal was dragged with him. At the shouted orders of the sergeant, they were placed on either side of a hitching rail, facing each other, their manacled wrists hooked into iron rings. The sergeant placed his forefinger in the back of the collar of Sir Francis's shirt and yanked down, splitting the cotton to the waist. Then he stepped back and swished his Malacca cane.
"You have made an oath on your knighthood. Do you stand by it on your honour?" Sir Francis whispered to his son.
"I do, father."
The cane snapped on his bare flesh, and Sir Francis winced.
"This beating is but a little thing, the play of children compared to what must follow, Hal. No matter what you do or say, nothing and no one can change the destiny I've seen for myself in the stars."
The cane hummed and cracked, and Sir Francis's body stiffened, then relaxed.
"If you are strong and constant, you will endure. That will be my reward. You are my body and my blood. Through you I also will endure."
The cane hummed and clapped again and again.
"Swear to me one last time, an oath on your knighthood, that you will never reveal anything to these people in a futile attempt to save me."
"Father, I swear it to you," Hal whispered back, his face white as bleached bone.
"I put all my faith and my trust in you," said Sir Francis.
And the soldiers lifted him down from the railing. His head was still high, and his bloody back straight, as they entered the hall and marched to their seats. Governor Van der Velde looked down at Schrauder.
"Who appears for the prosecution?"
Schrauder stood up.
"Colonel Cornelius Schrauder, Your Excellency."
"Who appears for the defense?"
Van der Velde glowered at Jacobus Hopp, and the clerk sprang to his feet.
I do, Your Excellency."
Van der Velde turned back to Schrauder.
"You may proceed, Colonel."
"This is a matter of piracy on the high seas, together with murder and abduction. The accused are 24 in number. The prosecution will prove that Francis Courtney, while commanding the caravel, the Lady Edwina, did fall upon the galleon at the Standvastighet, Captain Limburger commanding. And now, Your Excellency, if you please, I should like to call Captain Limburger."
When Schrauder had finished questioning him, Van der Velde looked at Hopp.
"Do you have any questions?"
Hopp stood up and blushed furiously.
No questions," he said.
"Who is your next witness, Colonel?"
Van der Velde asked.
"The governor's wife, Mevrouw Katinka Van der Velde."
With great deference, Schrauder led Katinka gently through the recital of her name and position, and then went on,
"Please tell us, madam, how you were treated by your captors."
Katinka began to sob softly.
"I was treated like a caged animal, cursed and spat at, kept locked up in a grass hut."
"My dear lady, do you believe that animals such as these should be shown mercy, or should they be subjected to the full force and majesty of the law?"
"I am only a poor female, with a soft, loving heart for all God's creation."
Katinka's voice broke pitifully.
"But hanging is too good for these unspeakable wretches. Burn them!"
A woman's voice screamed. Katinka lifted her head, and for the first time since entering the courts, she looked directly at Hal. Hal felt the love and awe he cherished for her withering.
"She was never worthy of you," Sir Francis said softly. "Now that you've renounced her, you've taken another mighty leap into manhood."
Did his father know what had taken place? Hal wondered. He turned and looked into Sir Francis's eyes. "I have committed adultery, and I have disgraced my knighthood," Hal whispered. "I am no longer worthy to be called your son." The manacle on his wrist clinked as Sir Francis laid his hand on the boy's knee. "The blame is not yours. You will always be my son, and I shall always be proud of you." As soon as his wife was seated, Vanderfelder beamed drovially about the hall. "We will adjourn for the midday meal and for the court to consider its verdict. We will reconvene at 4 o'clock this afternoon." Those last hours together went too swiftly for Hal. Bundled into his father's cell because of the shackles, he and his father spent the time talking softly together until they heard the guards approaching. Sir Francis turned to Hal. "For the last time, let me kiss you, my son." When Vanderfelder lowered himself into his seat, his smile was expansive. He looked squarely at the prisoners. "I find all 24 of the accused guilty of piracy, of robbery, and abduction and murder. Is there anything you wish to say before I pass sentence upon you?" Sir Francis spoke out in a voice that rang. "We are prisoners of war. You do not have the right to pass sentence upon us." Vanderfelder nodded mockingly. "I will deal firstly with the 4 Negroes. Let them stand forth." Vanderfelder regarded them sternly. "I've taken into account that you are ignorant savages, and therefore condemn you to lifelong slavery. You will be sold to the highest bidder at auction, and the monies received will be put into the company treasury. Take them away, Sergeant." As they were led from the hall, Abberley looked across at Sir Francis and Hal. His dark face was impassive, but he sent them the message of his heart. "Next I will deal with the white pirates," Vanderfelder announced. "Let the following prisoners stand forth." He read out every name, except that of Sir Francis Courtenay. "Have the armourer separate him from the other prisoner." The man hurried forward and worked swiftly. Sir Francis sat alone as Hal went forward. Vanderfelder studied their faces. "A more murderous bunch of cutthroats I have never laid eyes upon. I sentence every last man of you to a lifetime's labour in the service of the Dutch East India Company, and you will weep to the Almighty and beg him for the easy death that I denied you this day. Take them away, and put them to work immediately." Katinka hissed with frustration. Now she would be denied the thrill of watching slow John work on the beautiful brat and listening to his screams. When the file of convicts had left the hall, a hush fell, and every eye rested on the lonely figure on the bench. "Francis Courtenay," Vanderfelder said loudly. "Stand forth." Sir Francis rose, his head held high. "Francis Courtenay, I sentence you to death. But the manner of your death will be of your own choosing. Not all the cargo from the Standvastic hate has been recovered, and there is no doubt in my mind that you were able to secrete this before you were captured. Are you prepared to reveal the hiding place of the missing cargo? In that case, your execution will be by a swift and clean beheading." "I have nothing to tell you," said Sir Francis in a disinterested tone. "Then I fear you will be asked the same question under extreme compulsion by the state executioner." Vanderfelder smacked his lips. "Should you answer fully, the headsman's axe will put an end to your suffering. Should you remain obstinate, the questioning will continue. At all times the choice will remain yours." "Your Excellency is a paragon of mercy," Sir Francis bowed. "But I cannot answer the question, for I know nothing of the cargo of which you speak." "Then Almighty God have mercy on your soul," said Vanderfelder. "Take the prisoner away and place him in the charge of the state executioner." Sometimes, twice a day, Slow John came to the castle dungeon and stood at the peephole in the door of Sir Francis's cell. He never spoke. He stood there silently, sometimes for a few minutes, at others for an hour. It was a Sunday, the Lord's Day, when Mansir and four soldiers came for Sir Francis. They said nothing, but he could tell by their faces where they were taking him. Slow John's room was well lit. To one side, Jacobus Hopp sat at a writing table. He looked up at Sir Francis with a pale, terrified expression. Quickly he dropped his eyes. Along the far wall stood the rack. On the side wall a brazier smouldered. On hooks set into the wall above it hung an array of strange and terrible tools. The fire radiated a soothing, welcoming warmth. On that first long day of torture, Sir Francis had been carried, hands and feet enclosed in bloody bandages, from Slow John's room. He had called out to Hal in a clear, high voice, "Hal, remember your oath!" The next day, when at last Slow John re-emerged from below the armory, the soldiers brought out Sir Francis on a litter. "Father!" Hal shouted down, but there was no response. It was dark when the overseer, Hugo Barnard, ordered the exhausted prisoners down to their cells. As Hal passed his father's, he called desperately to him, "Father, can you hear me?"
"Hal," croaked a voice he did not recognize. "Be strong, my son. It will not be for much longer, but I charge you. If you love me, then keep the oath."
"I cannot let you suffer."
"Hal!"
His father's voice was suddenly powerful again.
"There is no suffering. I've passed that point. They cannot hurt me now, except through you. Tomorrow will be the day of my death. First the torture, then the execution."
"What can I do to ease you?"
"Let me take with me the knowledge of your strength and your fortitude. If you fail me now, it will all have been in vain."
Hal bit into the knuckles of his clenched fist.
"I will keep my faith with you, Father. I will not betray your trust."
"Farewell, Hal. You are my blood and my promise of eternal life. Goodbye, my life."
At 2 o'clock next day, they brought Sir Francis Courtney on a litter from the cell below the armory. They had not bothered to cover his naked body, grotesquely deformed by the rack. An execution detail fell in, their muskets at the slope. The tap, tap, tap of the death drum set the pace. The procession snaked through the castle gates, out onto the parade, where the crowd waited around the gibbet. Slow John wore his leather apron, and his head was covered with the mask of his office, the mask of death. The governor's carriage crossed the parade. Slow John's yellow eyes met those of Katinka. He bowed, and she knew that he was dedicating this death to her.
"He has no reason to act so grand," Van der Velde said grumpily. "He's killed the man without getting a word out of him."
A low growl came from the watchers as the executioner knelt to begin his task. When the crowd gave forth a lusty roar, the carriage horses shied at the sound and at the smell of fresh blood. With an impassive face, Aberley, who had been bought by Katinka to be her coachman, brought them back under control. Slowly he turned his head and looked towards the walls of the castle. He recognized Hal among the other convicts. No man or boy should ever have to watch his father die like this. Aberley looked back at the scaffold as Sir Francis Courtney's body rose slowly in the air. It was a matter of pride to Slow John that the last spark of life must not be snuffed out until after the drawing out of the viscera. For 4 days Sir Francis Courtney's dismembered body remained on public display, the gulls squabbling raucously over the feast. For once, Hal hated the clarity of his own eyesight that spared him no detail of the terrible transformation that was taking place as he watched. But on the dawning of the 5th day, the gibbet was empty.
"It is passing strange that they should have taken the corpse away so soon."
Daniel was puzzled.
"I would not have thought Van der Velde would be so compassionate."
The first morning that Aberley drove the governor down to the castle,
There was a stir and murmur among the convicts working on the walls as the carriage crossed the parade. They had recognized Aboli. Hal, however, realized that it would be unwise to remind his captors that Aboli had been his shipmate.
"Nobody to greet Aboli," he whispered urgently to Daniel. "Ignore him. Pass it on."
Aboli drew the team of greys to a halt at the foot of the staircase, and once Van der Velde had waddled up the stairs, Aboli returned to his seat and sat unmoving. An hour passed, and from the corner of his eye, Hal noticed Aboli climb down and go to the lead horse, examining its hoofs for injury. Screened by the horse's body from the view of any of the guards, he looked up at Hal. He nodded and opened his right fist to give Hal a glimpse of a tiny curl of paper, and then closed his fist and stood up. He leaned on the stone wall, and Hal watched him surreptitiously stuff the paper into a joint in the stonework. In the dusk, as the convicts wearily climbed down to the court, Hal stumbled and neatly extracted the scrap. The message was written in a fine, neat hand he did not recognize. A tiny nub of charcoal was wrapped in the paper for Hal to write his reply on the reverse. "The captain buried with honor." Hal's heart leapt, so it was Aboli who had taken down his father's mutilated corpse. There was only one more word. Althuda.
"Althuda," he called softly. "Somebody outside asks after you."
"I can guess who,"
Althuda called.
"And so can you. Can you send a reply? Tell her I am alive."
The second message Hal received was, "A is safe. Orchid sends her heart." Next morning, Mansia opened the door of Althuda's cell and roared,
"Come out, you murderous dog!
Governor's orders, you go to work on the wall. Seems you'll not be dancing a quadrille on the scaffold with Slow John."
Hal led the file of convicts up from the lower cells, and for a long moment he and Althuda studied each other keenly. Althuda was small, but his body was neat and strong and supple. That evening he was herded into the general cell, and they plied him with all the questions that they had not been able to shout up the staircase. "How many of your men are in the mountains?" Hal wanted to know.
"There were 19 of us, but 3 were killed by the Dutch, and 5 others died after we escaped."
"What weapons do they have?"
"Muskets and swords, and there is little powder, and by now it might all be used up. My companions have to hunt to live."
"What is the spirit of the men you took with you to the mountains?"
"Oh, they are brave men. And women, too. But they are not warriors, except one. Saba."
"Could we send word to him?"
"Well, when I escaped, I arranged with Sukina a hiding place beyond the bitter almond hedge of the colony, where we could leave messages for each other. I showed it to Saba."
"Aboli must try to make contact with Saba. Is there something that is known only to you and Saba that will prove to him the message is not a Dutch trap?"
"Say it is the father of little Bobby. Robert is my son, born after we escaped. Nobody inside the bitter almond hedge but I could know the child's name."
Throughout the winter, men sickened and died of exhaustion, of hunger, of sickness. But with spring came a message from Aboli in Sukina's hand. "Saba sends greetings to A. Bobby and his mother pine for him." It filled them all with a wild hope. Spring came in its full glory, and there was a laconic message from Sukina and Aboli. "It is time to go." There were 6 of them left. The evening before the planned escape, alone in the kitchen, Sukina boiled purple toadstools and reduced the essence to the consistency of new honey. She poured the liquid into an empty wine bottle. One of the women who worked in the kitchens at the barracks was in her debt. The next morning, she put the bottle in a basket with remedies and potions for Aboli to deliver. Aboli left a message that read, "Eat nothing from the garrison kitchen tonight." Next morning, Hal and his men looked at each other. They had never been left late before. When at last Mansir's keys rattled in the lock, he looked sickly.
"What ails you, Mansir?" Hal asked.
Oh, I spent the night sitting in the shithouse, and every man in the garrison was trying to get in with me. Half of them are still in their bunks.
Hugo Barnard was waiting in a foul mood.
"We have lost half a day's work," he snarled.
The diarrhea that afflicted the rest of the garrison had not touched him, because he lived with a Hottentot girl and did not eat in the garrison mess. Abberley brought the carriage round to the front of the residence. Katinka climbed in and ordered Sukina, "Come and sit here by me. There's a colour in your cheeks and a twinkle in your eye. One might be forgiven for thinking that you were in love." Sukina looked at her in a way that made Katinka's skin tingle.
"Oh, but I am in love," she whispered.
The carriage turned towards the castle, and Katinka called sharply,
"Abberley, what are you doing? Not the castle."
Sukina slipped her arm through her mistress's.
"We are going into the castle, and you are to do exactly what I tell you. Don't struggle, or I will cut your face so that you are no longer beautiful. Then I will send this blade through your evil heart."
Katinka looked down and saw the blade held to her side.
"Please," Katinka whimpered. "Please, Sukina, you said you loved me."
"And I lied," Sukina hissed at her. "For my brother's sake, I hate you. I loathe the touch of your hands."
Katinka saw death in her eyes.
"I will do as you tell me," she whispered.
"Dear, the devil's horns," the captain of the guard muttered to himself. "Why does the bitch choose today to arrive when half my men are sick as dogs?"
He saluted Katinka.
"Good morning, mevrouw."
"Call my husband. It is a matter of life and death. Go, hurry!"
While he was gone, Abberley went to the panniers at the back of the carriage and opened the lid. Then he glanced around the courtyard. With Barnard and his overseers, there were 10 armed men in sight, but any outcry could bring another 20 or 30 soldiers hurrying out of the barracks. He looked up. Hal already had the rope of the gantry in his hand, the tail looped around his wrist. Ned Tyler and Billy Rogers were on the lower tier, and the two birds, Finch and Sparrow, were working near Althuda in the courtyard. Abberley reached into the pannier and revealed the 3 Mughal scimitars and the single kukri knife he had taken from the governor's weapon collection. Thunderfelder arrived at the door of the carriage, panting wildly.
"What ails you, mevrouw?"
Abberley hooked one great arm around his neck and placed the blade of the kukri at his throat.
"Tell your soldiers to stay where they are and throw down their arms."
The subaltern had drawn his sword.
"Stop!"
Thunderfelder shouted in terror.
"Throw down your sword!"
The sword clattered down the steps. Hal sprang out from the scaffold, hanging on the rope from the gantry. The sheaves squealed as he landed on the cobbles. He swept up the subaltern's sword. He placed the point under the officer's chin and said, "Order your men to throw down their weapons."
"Lay down your arms, all of you,"
the subaltern yelled. The sentries obeyed with alacrity. Down from the scaffold scrambled the other seamen. Hal picked up a sword that a sentry had dropped and threw it to Big Daniel, who grinned.
"Sweet Jesus, it's good to have a real blade in me hand again," he exulted.
"Abberley, keep a firm hold on that great hog. The rest of you follow me."
Hal raced towards the doors of the armory and burst in.
"Pick your weapons and bring a keg of powder each," he ordered, and thrust a pair of pistols into the rope that served him as a belt.
He picked up a 50-pound keg of gunpowder, which he hoisted to his shoulder.
"That's enough, lads. Get out. Daniel, lay a powder trail as you go. I'm going to blow this place to hell. Go!"
As they sprinted away, a moan of horror and fear went up from every man in the yard. Thunderfelder screamed,
"Let me go! Run! Run!"
Within the time it takes to draw a long breath, the courtyard was deserted, except for the group of seamen around the carriage and Hal.
"Abberley, get Thunderfelder into the carriage. He and his wife are coming with us. Daniel, load the powder and the spare weapons. And one man to each horse. Lay hold of their rigging and let them tow you along."
Hal lit the powder train with the burning torch Daniel had bought for him, and then raced to meet the carriage. He was almost there when Abberley shouted,
Gondwane, behind you!
Hugo Barnard had appeared in the doorway where he and his hounds had taken shelter at the first sign of trouble. Now he sent them in pursuit of Hal. Hal lunged at the first while it was in the air and sent his point into the base of the black throat. The second sank its fangs into his left shin, and Hal felt its teeth grate on bone. Barnard reached them and raised his sword. The overseer's back was turned to the approaching carriage, and the rear wheel caught him a blow and sent him staggering aside. Hal drew his own sword, and when Barnard rushed at him again, thrust home.
"Hurry, Gondwane," Sukina called softly. "Oh, please hurry!"
Hal started forward. The dog had bitten deeply into his leg, but he could still run on it. He grabbed hold of the leading horse's harness, and Abeli gave the team its head. The carriage clattered out into the open parade. Suddenly from behind them came a shattering explosion, and the horses reared in terror. Hal looked back. A tower of smoke rose from the courtyard, shot through with dark flames and scraps of debris and wreckage. However, the massive outer walls were untouched by the detonation, and the barracks almost certainly withstood the blast. It was essential to move fast before Schrauder organized a pursuit. Once they had left the settlement behind them, the road surface deteriorated, and it was noon before they came to the Bitter Almond Hedge. Abeli turned the horses out, and Ned Tyler helped him to improvise pack saddles for them.
"What is to become of me, Sir Henry?" Katinka whispered.
"Some of the men want to take you up into the mountains and feed you to the wild animals," he replied. "Others want to cut your throat here and now. However, I find myself sick of you. I leave you to the mercy of God and the devil."
He turned and strode away. Sukina came out of the bushes. She had shed her skirts and wore a pair of Balinese breeches and a loose cotton shift. In the middle of the afternoon, they crossed a broad open flay where herds of wild antelope were grazing. The ground began to rise in a series of ridges towards the foothills. Hal moved heavily. Blood had seeped through the bandage Sukina had put on his leg. Abeli forced a halt. Sukina unwrapped the bandage and drew a sharp breath.
"You cannot walk further on this. You must ride."
Then from her saddlebags she fetched bread and dried sausage. She gave some to each of the men.
"God love you, princess," said Ned,
and all the others adopted the name. From then on, she was their princess. There was a warning shout from Daniel.
"There the bastards come at last!"
Even at that range, there was no mistaking Schrauder.
"How many men with him?" Abeli asked.
20, Hal counted. "He's chosen his fastest runners to press us hard. The rest will be following at their best speed. Master Daniel, take the rest of the party on. Abeli and I will stay here with one horse to slow down their advance. Do not come back for any reason," he told Althuda. And then he smiled at Sukina.
"Not even if Her Royal Highness commands it." She leaned close and whispered,
"I will wait for you on the mountain. Do not make me wait too long."
Hal went to the remaining horse and loosened one of the kegs of gunpowder. "Take the horse on, Abeli. Let Schrauder see you go. Tie it out of sight, then come back to me." He rolled the keg to the nearest outcrop of rock, and Abeli dropped back over the ridge and squatted beside him. Hal prized the bung from the keg and unwound the slow match he had tied around his waist. "I will take a chance on 3 fingers' length," he muttered. "I want to let them get very close." The two lay flat and peered down the hillside. Schrauder was in full view.
"Ready?" whispered Hal.
"Now, Abeli!"
Abeli seized the keg and leapt to his feet, almost under the hoofs of Schrauder's horse. The two Hottentot trackers with him yelled with shock and ducked off the path while the horse shied. Abeli hurled the keg out over the hillside. The Schrauder's horse leaped back down the slope almost onto the platoon of infantry, following close upon its heels. Schrauder's horse went down, and Schrauder fell clear as the keg exploded. The fall saved his life, for he had tumbled into the lee of a low rock outcrop, and the main force of the blast swept over him. However, it ripped through the horde of soldiers. Abeli seized Hal's arm and dragged him to the top of the ridge. Within a few paces, Hal's injured leg gave way under him. He did not protest when Abelie boosted him up onto the horse's back. Althuda had blazed the bark from the trees along his route. They followed at the best of their speed. "It seems Althuda is aiming for that dark gorge," Hal said. "Can you see them?"
"No," Abelie grunted. "But look behind you, Gondwane."
Hal turned and stared. "How can they have come so close, so quickly? They're gaining on us." Then Hal felt a mallet blow as a ball ploughed into the ribs of the grey mare an inch from his knee. The brave animal went down on its haunches.
"You will obey me, Gondwane," said Abelie, and snatched Hal's musket. "You will go on at your best speed while I hold them here."
Hal clasped Abelie's arm in a firm grip, and then hobbled on alone. As the path turned into the main gorge, Hal looked back and saw Abelie crouching with the two muskets on the rock in front of him. Hal turned the corner and saw the gorge open up above him like a great gloomy funnel. He launched himself up. Each of the huge, smooth boulders tested his injured leg to its limit. He dragged himself slowly upward until he reached a pool when he stopped in surprise. Althuda had left the horses tethered to a dead tree at the water's edge. When he looked beyond them to the stream bed, Hal knew why. They could no longer follow this dizzy path. His own courage faltered, but he heard from below a musket shot and angry shouts. He drove himself at the steep path, his heart pounding with exhaustion, until he reached a ledge. Here he dropped flat on his belly, and he saw Abelie coming up, leaping from rock to rock.
"Why have you not gone on, Gondwane?"
"No time for talking." Hal snatched one of the muskets and began to reload it. "We have to hold them here. Reload!" Musket balls began to buzz and crack around their heads as the first wave of a dozen climbers hurled themselves at the rock wall. Hal aimed at the nearest climber, and his ball struck him in the mouth, and he fell backwards, crashing into the three men below him. All four plummeted down to shatter on the rocks below. Abelie fired and sent another two green jackets slithering downwards.
"We must retreat."
Hal flung down his musket and, with Abelie at his side, went up the treacherous slope.
"Hal Courtney!"
a voice called from a dark crack in the rock. In its depths were two men, Althuda and a stranger dressed in animal skins. Hal and Abelie threw themselves at the narrow opening and squeezed in. The stranger, a short-handled axe in his hand, severed a rope of plaited bark. There was a rumbling and a crackling as though a sleeping giant had stirred.
"Saba has triggered the rock fall," he made,
Althuda explained, and the rumbling became a roar, and above it Hal could hear the wild, terrified screams of the green jackets caught full in the path of this avalanche. At last silence, complete and oppressive, weighed down upon them. Abelie and Hal crept out. From wall to wall the gorge had been scoured clean. There was no sound or trace of their pursuers, not a last despairing cry or dying moan. It was as though they had never been.
"So you lost almost 40 men, Schroeder?"
Van der Velde asked heavily.
"And the convicts and slaves got clean away?"
Schroeder scowled furiously.
"The security of the castle is your responsibility, Schroeder. The company surveyor places the damages at over 100,000 guilders. What do you imagine will be the reaction of the Council of 17 in Amsterdam when they receive my full report detailing the depths of the dereliction of your duties, hey? Schroeder, I am sending you back to Amsterdam in the deepest disgrace. You will sail aboard the Weltrevden, which is anchored in the bay."
Schroeder knew he could never obey Van der Velde's orders to return home to Holland. He would be a pariah. But neither could he remain here at Good Hope. He must find some other land where his shame was unknown. Now his gaze focused on the shipping anchored out in the bay. There were only two foreign vessels. One was a Portuguese, the other an English frigate, the Golden Bough. When Schroeder hailed the deck of the frigate, a petty officer led him down to the stern cabin where Captain Christopher Llewellyn rose to welcome him. First they discussed the recent hostilities, then went on to speak about maritime trade in the Eastern Oceans. My present voyage is in response to an appeal by the Christian king of Ethiopia, the Prester John, for military assistance in this war against the forces of Islam, said Llewellyn. The great Mogul has sent his fleet and an army under his younger brother, Sadiq Khan Jahan, to seize the countries that make up the seaboard of the Great Horn of Africa from the Christian king. I belong to a chivalric order, the Knights of the Temple of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail, committed to defend the Christian faith and the holy places of Christendom.
I am acquainted with several of your brother knights, Scrowder said. The Earl of Cambrai, for one.
Llewellyn sniffed.
He is not a prime example of our membership.
I have also met Sir Francis Courtney, Scrowder went on.
Oh, I know him well, Llewellyn exclaimed. A fine seaman and gentleman. Do you know where I might find Frankie?
I'm afraid that Sir Francis was a casualty of the recent war between our two countries, Scrowder phrased it diplomatically. Captain, no doubt the Prester will be in need of military as well as naval assistance. Would you look kindly upon my request for passage to the theatre of war? For myself and the lady who is to be my wife, I would pay in gold coin.
I should be honoured by your company. However, I must sail with the tide. I will have a boat take you ashore and wait for you.
Scrowder went first to Katinka's reading room. She was not there. A female slave looked up, startled.
Where is your mistress? He demanded.
In her bedroom. She's not to be disturbed. She left strict instructions.
Scrowder stepped out onto the long veranda. He went down to the windows that opened into the principal bedroom suite. And the windows to Katinka's closet were shuttered. He eased open the shutters and stepped inside. Katinka's perfume assailed his senses. Then, in the gloom, he made out the pearly sheen of her flawless white skin. She was nude, her back turned to him, her hair cascading down to the cleft of her perfect buttocks. She turned her head, and all the colour drained from her face. Then he saw that she was seated astride a masculine form, riding him like a steed. With one explosive movement, Katinka sprang off.
"What are you doing in my bedroom?" she hissed.
"I came to take you away with me."
The man sat upright and looked at Scrowder with a flat, yellow gaze. A wave of unspeakable horror and revulsion swept over Scrowder. Katinka had been rutting with Slow John, the executioner. Katinka was speaking, but her words barely made sense to him.
"You came to take me away? You, the laughingstock of the colony? Get out of here, you fool! Go into obscurity and shame, where you belong."
Slow John stood up from the bed.
"You heard her. Get out."
It was not the words, but the fact that Slow John's penis was still fully tumescent that turned Scrowder into a maniac. With one fluid movement, the Neptune sword sprang from its scabbard as though it were a living thing. Slow John had neither time nor chance to evade the stroke. As he sank to his knees, Katinka began to scream. The dreadful sound echoed in his head and made it ache, and he had to make her stop. The sword in his hand flew without his brain or his hand commanding it, and he stabbed her satiny white belly. Her scream turned to an agonized shriek, and he thrust again and again to quieten her. And then slowly the black rage drained from his brain, and Colonel Scrowder staggered back against the wall. Katinka lay in the wide, deep pool of her own blood, and her features were twisted into a rictus of terror and agony. Her blood was moving softly across the tiles like a fat, lazy adder. As he watched, it reached the edge of the smaller puddle in which Slow John lay. Their blood ran together, and Scrowder felt a deep sense of sacrilege that the pure should mingle thus with the base. Hal woke to a sense of peace, such as he had seldom known before. He realized that he was warm and lying on a comfortable mattress. He expected the dungeon stench to assail him, the moldy odor of damp, rotting straw, the smell of men who had not bathed for a 12-month. Instead, he smelled fresh woods, perfumed and sweet, the scent of burning cedar faggots. Suddenly the memories came flooding back, and he remembered their escape. He lay and savored that knowledge. He opened his eyes slowly, and was dazzled by strong mountain light through the opening of the shelter in which he lay. He looked around and saw clay pots and crudely fashioned tools and implements stacked against the inner wall. A bow and quiver hung from a peg near the door. Beside them were his sword and pistols. A lissome figure appeared in the opening, backlit by the sunshine, so that she was only a lovely silhouette. Though he could not see her face, he knew straight away who it was.
"Good morrow, Gundwane. You have slept long. But did you sleep well?" Sukina asked shyly. "This is my nephew, Bobby."
She joggled the baby on her hip, and he gurgled with delight. "How long did I sleep?" Hal asked, beginning to rise, but she passed the baby to someone outside, and came quickly to kneel beside the mattress. She restrained him with a small, warm hand on his naked chest.
"Gently, Gundwane. You have been in a fever sleep for days."
"I'm well again now," he said, and then recognized the mysterious perfume he had noticed earlier. It was her woman smell, the flowers in her hair and the soft warmth of her skin.
"Not yet," she contradicted him,
and he let her ease his head back onto the mattress.
"I have never seen anything so beautiful as you," he said, and then reached up and touched his own cheek. "My beard." "It is gone," she laughed. "I stole a razor from the fat governor especially for the task."
She cocked her head on one side.
"With the beard gone, you also are beautiful, Gundwane."
She blushed slightly as she realized the import of her words, and Hal watched in delight as the red gold suffused her cheeks. She turned her full attention to his injured leg, drew back the fur blanket to expose it, and unwound the bandage.
"Ah," she murmured as she touched it lightly, "it heals marvelously well with a little help from my medicines. You have been fortunate. The bite and then the abuse to which you put the limb during our flight might have killed you or crippled you."
For a time they looked at each other without speaking, openly examining each other's face in detail. Then Hal asked, "Where are we, Sukina?" He made a gesture. "This hut."
"It is Saba's. He has lent it to us."
"So we're in the mountains at last?"
"Deep in the mountains, in the place where the Dutch can never find us."
"I want to see," he said. She helped him to stand, and offered her shoulder to him as he hopped to the opening in the thatched shelter. He sank down and leaned against the doorpost of rough cedar.
"'Tis a vision of paradise," he said at last.
The peaks that surrounded them were wild and splendid. The cliffs and gorges were all the colours of the artist's palette. The light fell full upon the mountain tops across the deep valley and covered them with a golden radiance. The water of the stream below was as clear as the air they breathed, and Hal could see the fish lying in shadows on the yellow sandbanks, fanning their dark tails.
"It is strange. I have never seen this place, nor any like it. And yet I feel as though I know it well. I feel a sense of homecoming, as though I was waiting to return here." "'Tis not strange, Henry Courtenay. I also was waiting."
She turned her head and looked deep into his eyes.
"I was waiting for you. I knew you would come. The stars told me. That day I first saw you parade outside the castle, I recognized you as the one."
There was so much to ponder in that simple declaration that he was silent again for a long while, watching her face. "My father was also an adept. He was able to read the stars," he said.
"Aboli told me."
"So you too can divine the future from the stars, Sukina?" She did not deny it.
"My mother taught me many skills. I was able to see you from afar."
"So you must know what is to become of us, you and me?" She smiled, and there was a mischievous gleam in her eye. She slipped a slim arm through his.
"I would not have to be a great sage to know that, Gondwane.
But there is much else that I am able to tell of what lies ahead." "Tell me, then," he ordered. But she smiled again and shook her head. There will be time later. We will have much time to talk while your leg heals and you grow strong again. She stood up. But now I will fetch the others. I cannot deny them any longer. They came immediately, but Abberley was the first to arrive. He greeted Hal in the language of the forests.
I see you well, Gondwani. I thought you would sleep forever.
Without your help, I might indeed have done so. Then Big Daniel and Ned and the others came to touch their foreheads and mumble their self-conscious greetings and squat in a semicircle in front of him. Big Daniel spoke for them all when he asked,
Well, what are we going to do now, Sir Hal?
Are you seamen or mountaineers? Hal answered his question with a question, and some of the men chuckled.
We were born in Davy Jones's locker, and we all of us have salt water for blood, Ned Tyler answered. Then I will have to take you down to the sea and find you a ship, won't I? Said Hal. Master Daniel, I want a manifest of all the weapons, powder, other stores that we were able to bring with us. First, powder.
Oh, only what we had in our flasks.
Well, when you went on ahead, you had 2 full kegs on the horses.
Well, those kegs weighed 50 pounds apiece.
Daniel looked ashamed.
Too much cargo for us to haul.
I've seen you carry twice that weight. Hal was angry and disappointed. Then Ned asked, Were you serious when you promised us a ship, Captain? Sukina stood up from the fire.
That's enough for tonight. He must regain his strength before you plague him further. You must go now. You may come again tomorrow.
When they had gone, Sukina came and sat close beside him. In a natural, possessive manner, Hal placed his arm around her shoulders. She leaned her slim body against him and fitted her head into the notch of his shoulder. She sighed a sweet, contented sound, and neither spoke for a while.
I want to stay here at your side like this forever. But the stars may not allow it, she whispered. The season of our love may be short as a winter day.
Don't say that, Hal commanded. Never say that.
He felt a sense of hopelessness and sadness come upon him. He shivered. Immediately she sat up straight and said softly,
You go cold, Gondwani.
She helped him to his feet and led him into the hut, to the bed against the far wall. She laid him upon it and then lit the wick of the small clay oil lamp and placed it on a shelf in the rock wall. She went to the fire and lifted off the clay pot of water that stood on the coals. She poured steaming water into an empty dish and mixed in water from the pot beside the door until the temperature suited her. With slow, voluptuous movements, she unwrapped the sarong around her waist and threw it aside. The buttocks were small, and the deep cleft divided them into perfect ovals. She squatted beside the dish to soak a small cloth in the scented water and to bathe herself. She started at her shoulders and washed each arm to her long, tapered fingertips. Hal realized that it was a ritual bath she was performing, part of a ceremony she was enacting before him. He watched avidly each move she made, and every now and then she looked up at him and smiled. She stood at last and turned slowly to face him. Once he had thought her body boyish, but now he saw that it was so feminine that his heart swelled hard with desire for her. She stepped away from the dish and dried herself on the cotton shift she had discarded. Then she went to the oil lamp, cupped one hand around the wick, and leaned towards it, as if to snuff out the flame. No, said Hal. Leave the light. I want to look at you. At last she came to him, gliding across the stone floor on small bare feet, crept onto the bed beside him into his arms, and folded her body against his. She held her lips to his mouth. Hers was soft and wet and warm, and her breath mingled with his and smelled of the wild flowers she had worn in her hair.
I have waited all my life for you, she whispered into his mouth.
He whispered back, It was too long to wait, but I'm here at last. In the morning she proudly displayed the treasures she had brought for him in her saddlebags. She had somehow procured everything he had asked for in the notes he had left for Abberley in the wall of the castle.
He snatched up the charts.
Where did you get these from, Sukina?
And she was delighted to see how much value he placed upon them.
These are more than I ever hoped for, Sukina.
The charts were obviously some navigator's treasures, highly detailed and covered with notations and observations in a well-formed, educated hand. To his amazement, the location of Elephant Lagoon was marked on one, the first time he had ever seen it shown on any chart other than his father's. Hal laid aside these precious documents and took up the backstaff Sukina had found. The instrument was of extraordinarily fine workmanship, and the compass she had brought was so finely balanced that its magnetic needle swung unerringly into the north. With these instruments in his hands, he could move with authority through this savage wilderness. There were cutlasses enough to arm every man, and pistols too. Their lack was in powder, slow match, and lead ball. They had less than 5 pounds weight of black powder, not enough for 20 discharges. Hal looked at Abberley. Abberley, where would you look for the buzzard?
Whatever he smells gold, or the promise of easy pickings, like the carrion bird for which he is named.
Yes! Hal clapped him on the shoulder. But where might the smell of gold be strongest? Why did the buzzard buy Jiri and our other black shipmates at auction?
A slow smile spread over Abberley's face.
Elephant Lagoon! He exclaimed.
How far are we from Elephant Lagoon?
By my reckoning, 300 sea miles.
Abberley looked at Hal.
How long will the journey take us, Gundwani?
If we can make good 10 miles a day, perhaps over a month.
That night, Hal explained the plan to the others. I will prevail on no man to come with us. If any man wish to remain, we will leave half the store of weapons with you, and think no ill of you. Do any of you wish to speak?
Yes, said Sukina. I go wherever you go.
Bravely spoken, princess, grinned Neb Tyler, and I go also.
Aye, said the other seamen in unison. We're all with you.
Hal smiled with genuine pleasure.
Now we must make our preparations.
Sukina spoke out firmly.
Your leg will not be healed for at least another 5 days. I will not allow you to march upon it before then.
During those last days, Hal and Sukina foraged for the herbs and plants that she would use for medicine and food. On the day before the journey was due to commence, the two stopped at midday to bathe and rest, and make love beside a stream, and afterwards Hal lay surfeited with passion in the warm sunlight. He was roused by the sound of Sukina's digging stick pounding into the earth. A few minutes later she returned with a crumbling lump of yellow earth in her hand.
Flower crystals! The first I have found in these mountains!
She looked delighted with her discovery.
What do you use this earth for? He asked.
Oh, it has many uses. She reeled off the ailments that she could treat with it, but to Hal it looked like any other clod of earth. That night, while the band held their final council, Sukina pounded clods of earth and mixed the powder into a pot of water. She heated this over the fire, then sat beside Hal as he went over the order of march.
Sweet heaven! He cried. What have you in this pot, Sukina?
'Tis the yellow flowers.
I would know that smell in hell, he kissed her. Lads, the princess's pot is filled with brimstone.
Sukina led a party back to the ravine in which she had discovered the sulphur deposit, and while she supervised the boiling and leaching of the sulphur crystals, one-eyed Johannes tended the slow fires in which bulks of cedarwood were being reduced to charcoal. Hal and Saba's band climbed the mountainside to reach the cliffs in which the multitudes of rock rabbits had their colonies. They clung to the precipice like flies as they scraped away the amber-coloured crystals of dried urine. They worked in shifts to keep the fires burning all day and night, exciting the sulphur from the powdered earth and the saltpeter from the animal excreta, until the day Hal started to mix the three constituents of gunpowder together. Abberley handed Hal one of the muskets, and he measured a charge and dribbled it down the barrel. An expectant silence fell as he took aim and pressed the trigger.
There was a thunderous report and a blinding cloud of smoke. The wooden target shattered, and an exultant cheer went up from everyone.
As fine a grade of powder as you can find in the naval stores in Greenwich, Ned Tyler opined.
10 days later than they had first intended, the band set out into the east. Before the Golden Bough had made her offing from Good Hope, Captain Christopher Llewellyn was already regretting having taken on board his paying passenger. Colonel Schrowder was arrogant, outspoken, and highly opinionated. On the morning of the fifth day, a storm hurled itself upon the Golden Bough, howling with fury. For 2 days the wind never ceased its assault upon them, and the seas grew taller and wilder with every hour. Llewellyn had lashed himself to the mainmast, and from there he directed the efforts of his officers and men to keep the ship alive. Always the land loomed closer in their lee as the storm drove them onwards under bare masts, and though the helmsman strained much to hold her off, the Golden Bough edged in towards the land. Schrowder dragged himself across the deck and gasped at Llewellyn.
"I know this coast. I recognize that headland coming up ahead of us. There is a bay, which we name the Buffalo Bay. Once she is into it, the ship should be sheltered, and on the far side there stand a pair of rocky heads that guard the entrance to a wide and calm lagoon. There we would be safe from even such a storm as this."
"First we must weather those rocks, and after that we can prove quality of your memory."
Schrowder clung desperately to the mast beside Llewellyn. He stared ahead in horror as he watched the snarling lips of white foam and bare fangs of black rock. Claws of stone seemed to reach out towards the frail planks of the ship, and her keel touched the rock. She checked with such force that Schrowder was hurled to the deck, but the ship shook herself free, surged onwards, carried on the crest of that mighty wave, and slid off the reef into the deeper water beyond. Though she still hurtled on wildly, she was coming back under control.
"There!" Schrowder screamed in Llewellyn's ear. "There! Dead ahead!"
"Sweet heaven, you were right!"
Through the spume and sea fret, Llewellyn picked out the shape of the twin heads over the ship's bows. Like an arrow from a longbow, the Golden Bough darted between the heads and sped through the channel into the quiet lagoon. Llewellyn gazed at the green forested shores in wonder and relief. Then he started and pointed ahead.
"There's another ship at anchor here already."
"I know that vessel," Schrowder cried. "'Tis Lord Cambrai's ship. 'Tis the Gull of Moray."
With Abelly's guidance, they were coming to terms with this savage terrain and the great animals that abounded in it. Fear was no longer their constant companion, and Hal and Sukina had learned to take pleasure in the strangeness and beauty all around them. On the open lands there were flocks of small cinnamon-coloured gazelles. Each ewe was followed by a tiny lamb, and Sukina clapped her hands with delight. Hal watched her fondly, knowing that she carried a child within her, and revelling with her in the secret. He read the angle of the noon sun, and everyone in the band gathered around him to watch him mark their position on the chart.
"We're not more than 5 leagues from the lagoon now."
Hal looked up. "In the morning, Abelly and I will go on ahead to discover if the gull is truly lying in Elephant Lagoon." As soon as it was light enough to see the track that led eastwards, Hal and Abelly left the cab. Sukina walked a short distance with them. She watched them climb the hill, but as they disappeared, a single tear traced its way down her cheek. When last they had been here, Hal and Abelly had hunted and explored these hills above the lagoon. Now they climbed the back slope of the hills until they were a few paces below the skyline.
"Use those trees to break your shape on the skyline," Abelly told him quietly.
Hal smiled. "You taught me well. I have not forgotten." He inched his way up the last few yards, and gradually the view down the far side opened to his gaze. He had not had sight of the sea for weeks now, and he felt his heart leap as he looked upon its serene blue expanse. It was it that ruled his life, and he had missed it sorely.
"Oh, for a ship," he whispered. "Please God, let there be a ship."
As he moved up, there before his eyes appeared the great grey castles of the Heads, the bastions that guarded the entrance to the lagoon. He paused, steeling himself for the terrible disappointment of finding the anchorage deserted. He forced himself to take another slow step, and then gasped, seized Abelie's arm, and dug his fingers into the knotted muscles. "The Gull! And there's another fine ship with her!" His voice sharpened with hatred. "The Buzzard is going out to her."
"Who is that greeting him at the companionway? I swear I know that bald scalp."
"It's Sam Bowles." Abelie pointed down the hill.
"They are digging fortifications down there. But there is no plan to them."
Hal laughed. "Of course. He's still searching for my father's hoard." Abelie chuckled.
"Perhaps Jiri and Matezi have deliberately misled him."
"Of course. Combray bought more than he bargained for in the slave market. They will tweak his nose while they pretend to grovel and call him Lordy." Abelie started and pointed excitedly.
"There is Jiri, and Matezi, and Kimati behind him. They are taking them to a hut near the water's edge. That must be where they lock them up at night."
Abelie crawled swiftly across the sand until he came to the rear of the hut. He whispered softly,
"Jiri."
A fearful whisper came back.
"Is that the voice of Abelie,
or is it his ghost?" "I am alive. Here, feel the warmth of my finger."
Dawn was painting the eastern sky when Abelie climbed the hill again and related everything that Jiri had been able to tell him about the massacre of the captain and men of the Golden Bough.
"Jiri says the survivors are locked up in the main hold of the Golden Bough. He says the Buzzard has given the command of the Bough to Sam Bowles."
"All this could work out to our advantage," Hal exclaimed. "Come with me, Abelie." Hal led him to the cave where Sir Francis had hidden his treasure. Abelie laughed.
"You are a rich man, Gondwane. But what use is all this gold and silver to you now?"
"I came for this." Hal kicked the powder beside him. "And those." He pointed to the piles of muskets and swords stacked against the far wall. "Now, let us return to Sukina and the others. I have a plan." That night, Hal launched the two fireships left over from his first battle with the Buzzard. They piled bundles of cutlasses and a chest filled with loaded pistols into the first. Then Hal placed Sukina in the second. "Keep out of danger until we have secured the ship. Listen to Ned. He knows what to do." He ran back to take command of the first boat. They were a cable's length from the Golden Bough when the night was shattered by thunder, and from the dark grove flames shot up into the night sky. "The first explosion will bring them running," Hal had explained to Abelie before sending him off to prepare the powder kegs. "Then the second will go off in their faces." Hal saw with satisfaction that a skiff was moored alongside the Golden Bough, a rope ladder dangling into her from the deck above. He could hear a babble of voices above. The crew must be staring at the flames in bewilderment. They bumped softly against the side of the empty skiff. Immediately, Hal swarmed up the rope ladder. As he had hoped, the skeleton crew were all watching the disturbance. Jiri had told Abelie they were holding the frigate's loyal crew in the main hold. He ran and dropped on his knees behind the hatch combing. He spoke quietly.
"Ahoy there, Golden Bough. Do you hear me?"
A muffled voice answered immediately.
"Who are you?"
"An honest Englishman, come to set you free.
Will you fight with us against the Buzzard?"
"God love you! We beg you for a taste of his mongrel blood."
Hal glanced round. Big Daniel had brought up a bundle of cutlasses, and Althuda had the chest of pistols.
"We have weapons for you," Hal whispered.
"Lend a hand to throw back the hatch when I knock out the wedges. Then come out fighting, but call your ship's name, so we will know you and you us."
With a wild shout, a pack of pirates led by Sam Bowles charged across the deck. They were 20 against 2, but Daniel and Hal held them long enough for the seamen of the Golden Bough to dash into the fight. Within minutes, the deck was thronged with struggling men.
Hal killed one with a thrust under his raised arm into his heart, and disarmed another with a neat slash across his wrist that severed his straining sinews. Hal's other two attackers drew back in fear, and in the respite he looked around for Sam Bowles. Sam Bowles was at the rail at the stern, overlooking the lower deck. There was a heavy bronze murderer in the slot of the rail aimed directly at Hal. In the instant before it fired, Hal leapt forward, seized the pirate in front of him, and lifted him off his feet. Hal held him like a shield, just as the murderer fired. He felt the body of the man in his arms jump as a dozen heavy pellets smashed into him. He was dead even before Hal dropped him to the deck. But the shot had done fearful slaughter to the crew of the Golden Bough. Three were down, and two were struck, struggling to stay on their feet. The pirates saw that the balance had tipped in their favor. Hal's men started to give way. They were seconds from total rout, when from over the rail rose a great black, tattooed face. Abelly let out a bellow that froze them all where they stood. He was followed closely by three other huge shapes, each with a cutlass in hand. The pirates fled. Those unable to swim scuttled down into the bowels of the frigate, while the others jumped overboard. Hal strode to the quarter-deck. "Stand by to get the ship underway. Master Daniel, get the women on board." Hal felt a great lift of his heart as he saw Ned Tyler was already at the whipstaff. "Full on by, Mr. Tyler," he said. "Full on by, tis, Captain." Ned could not suppress his grin, and Hal grinned back at him. "Will this ship do you, Mr. Tyler?" "Well enough," Ned said, and his eyes sparkled. Hal strode to the rail and looked across to the beach. The fire had taken fierce hold on the forest, and now the scene was like the dawn. Combray was in front of his men, his face swollen with rage. Then Hal recognized the man who stood higher up the beach. Cornelius Scrowder's reptilian stillness was chilling. Hal felt a small, warm hand creep into his and looked down to Sakina's sweet face. Big Daniel came up to them, dragging with him an abject figure.
"Sweet Sir Henry, I pray you to have mercy on an old shipmate."
"Sam Bowles," Hal tried to keep his voice level, "you have enough innocent blood on your conscience to float a frigate. I will deal with him in the morning. Train him to the mainmast and put two good men to guard him. Make sure that this time he does not cheat us of vengeance."
Taking Sukina with him, Hal went below and led her into the small cabin adjoining the captain's. "You will be able to rest here undisturbed," he told her.
"There are wounded men who need my help," she said.
"Your unborn son and I need you more," he told her firmly, and pushed her down gently on the bunk.
He went through to the main cabin and sat down at Llewellyn's desk. He opened the great black leather-covered Bible and read the inscription, "Christopher Llewellyn, Esquire, born 16th of October in the year of grace 1621. Below it was another, "Consecrated as a Nortonier Knight of the Temple of St. George and the Holy Grail, 2nd of August, 1643. Knowing that the man who had captained this ship before him was a brother knight gave Hal a deep pleasure. He sat the rest of the night at Llewellyn's desk, studying the ship's books and papers. Abelly came to fetch him an hour after the sun had risen.
"It would be best if you spoke to the new men as soon as you can, Gundwani. You must convince them to sail under your command. If they refuse, there is little we can do. There are 30 of them, and only 6 of us."
When Hal and Sukina stepped out onto the deck together, Hal was freshly shaved and dressed in clean clothing from Llewellyn's locker. They made an extraordinary couple, the tall young Englishman and the Oriental beauty. Hal strode out in front of the men.
"I'm Henry Courtney, a sailor, as you are." One called out, "I sailed with your father, Sir Francis. He was a seaman and a fighter, and an honest man to boot." Then another cried, "Last night you took down 7 of the buzzard scum of your own blade. The pup is well bred from the old dog."
They began to cheer him, so he could not speak, and at last he held up his hand. "I've read the charter Captain Llewellyn had with the owner,
and I know the Golden Bough was bound for the kingdom of Prester John to fight the infidel. We have a choice, you and I. We can sail back home to England, or I can take over Captain Llewellyn's charter. You can sign on with me, but remember that the chances are strong that we will run in with the buzzard again, and you will have to fight him once more.
"I'm with you, Captain," shouted a fair-headed sailor. "Bring me the book, and I'll make a cross so big and black it will fright the devil himself."
They all roared with fierce laughter.
"We're with you! My oath and my mark on it!"
"Then make sail, and bring the ship to her true course for the great Horn of Africa." Abelly came to Hal in the forenoon watch.
"You must deal with some bowls now. The men are becoming impatient."
They were forced to drag Sam Bowles to face his accusers. He was weeping loudly.
"Oh, for the love of sweet Jesus, have mercy, Sir Henry."
An image appeared in the eye of Hal's mind. It was of his father being borne away to the scaffold, his body broken and twisted from the rack.
"Mr. Tyler, the prisoner is to be hanged immediately. Reeve a rope to the main yard."
"Gondwane, behind you!"
Sam Bowles had reached under his petticoats. Strapped to the inside of his thigh was a leather sheath. In his hand the blade of the stiletto sparkled like a sliver of crystal. The dagger flitted across the space that separated them, and Sukina flung out one slim arm to block the throw. The silver blade struck an inch below her elbow and buried itself to the haft.
"Help me here! Hold her arm!"
Hal called to Abelly, who plucked the blade from Sukina's flesh. Hal lifted her in his arms and started towards the companionway. A wild scream stopped him. Sam Bowles stood beneath the dangling rope.
"You bitch, he's dead, Henry Courtney. Just like your bastard sire. Sam Bowles killed both of them." "Glory be, Captain Bloody Courtney. Remember me in your prayers. I'm the man you will never forget."
"You're the one who is dead, Sam Bowles," said Ned Tyler savagely, snugging the noose down under Sam's ear.
The instant before the rope came up tight and stopped his breath, Sam screamed again,
"Look well at the blade that cut your whore, Captain. Think on Sam Bowles when you try to point."
The rope bit into his throat, and the crew howled with wolf-like glee as Sam Bowles rose spiraling into the air. But Hal was staring in horror at the knife. A narrow groove down the length of the blade was filled with a black tarry paste that had dried hard and shiny.
"It is an assassin's blade," Ned said quietly. "The groove is filled with poison."
The hours passed, and twice Hal heard the ship's bell announce watch changes. He felt Sukina grow weaker and sink away from him. She opened her eyes and smiled softly.
"I'm sorry, my love. I have to go now.
If you forget all else, remember only this,
that I loved you as no other woman will ever be able to love you."
At midnight, Hal carried the woman up onto the open deck. Under the bright African moon, he gave her to the sea. They cleared Cape Guardafui at the tip of the great Rhino Horn of Africa, and before them opened the Gulf of Aden. Weeks earlier, they had replenished the crew with 100 men of Abelly's tribe, and now they were ready to join the army of the Christian Emperor. In daylight they passed into the Maw of the Red Sea, and Hal shortened sail, for these were treacherous waters, dotted with hundreds of islands and sown with reefs of fanged coral. Swiftly, Hal learned how inaccurate were the charts that he had found in Llewellyn's desk. Some of the islands they passed were not shown, and others were depicted leagues off their true position. The marked soundings were mere fictions of the cartographer's imagination. The nights were moonless, and Hal dared not press on in the darkness. At dusk, he anchored in the lee of one of the larger islands.
"No lights," he warned Ned Tyler. "And keep the hands quiet."
When he came up on deck again at the beginning of the first dog watch, the ship was silent and dark. He made his rounds,
then went to stand alone by the rail, lost in wonder at the glory of the stars. Suddenly, he heard an alien sound, and then he realized that it was human voices speaking a language that he did not know. He moved swiftly to the stern, and the sounds were closer and clearer. He heard the creak of rigging and the squeak and splash of oars. He ran forward and found Aboli.
"Assemble an armed boarding party, 10 men, he whispered. "No noise. Launch the longboat."
As the longboat touched the water, they dropped into it and pulled away. Hal steered into the darkness. After several minutes, he whispered,
"Avast heaving!"
And the rowers rested on their oars. The minutes drifted by. Then, suddenly, close at hand, they heard something clatter on a wooden deck. Hal strained his eyes in that direction and saw the pale set of a small lateen sail against the starlight.
"All together! Give way!"
he whispered, and the boat shot forward. Aboli stood in the bows with a grappling hook and line. The small dhow that emerged abruptly out of the darkness dead ahead was not much taller at the rail than the longboat. Aboli hurled the hook over her side and leaned back on the line. The crew, with a blood-curdling chorus of yells, swarmed up onto the deck of the strange craft. They were met by pathetic cries of dismay and terror. Hal lashed the tiller over, seized the hooded lantern, and rushed up after his men to restrain their belligerence. He opened the shutter of the lantern, and flashing it around, found the crew of the dhow had already been subdued, and were spread-eagled on the deck. There were a dozen or so half-naked, dark-skinned sailors, but among them was an elderly man dressed in a full-length robe. "Bring that one here," he ordered. When they dragged the captive to him, Hal saw that he had a flowing beard and a cluster of Coptic crosses and rosaries dangling down onto his chest. The square mitre on his head was embroidered with gold and silver thread. "All right," he cautioned the men who held him. "Treat him gently. He's a priest." "Do you speak English, father?" The man showed no sign of having understood. Hal switched into Latin. "Who are you, father?" "I am Phasilides, Bishop of Axum, confessor to his Christian Majesty Iazu, Emperor of Ethiopia," he replied in fluent, scholarly Latin.
"I beg your forgiveness, Your Grace. I mistook this ship for an Islamic marauder. I crave your blessing."
Hal went down on one knee.
"In nomine Patris et Filio et Spiritu Sancto,"
he intoned, and gave Hal his ring to kiss. He seemed sufficiently mollified for Hal to press the advantage.
"This is a most providential encounter, Your Grace." Hal rose to his feet again. "I'm a knight of the Temple of the Order of St. George of the Holy Grail. I'm on a voyage to place my ship and its company at the disposal of the Prester John, the most Christian emperor of Ethiopia, in his holy war against the forces of Islam. As His Majesty's confessor, perhaps you could lead me to his court."
"It may be possible to arrange an audience," said Phasilides importantly.
However, his aplomb was shaken and his manner much improved when the dawn light revealed the power and magnificence of the Golden Bough, and he became even more amenable when Hal invited him aboard and offered to convey him on the rest of his journey. Phasilides brought his 2 servants aboard with him, and one of the fishermen from the dhow to act as a pilot for Hal. With a local pilot on board, Hal was able to head on towards Mitsiwa with all dispatch, not even deigning to shorten sail when the sun set that evening. Hal invited Phasilides to dine with him, and the good bishop showing a deep affinity for Llewellyn's brandy, his dignity lowered in proportion to the level in the brandy decanter, and he answered Hal's questions with less and less reserve.
"The emperor is with General Nazet at the monastery of St. Luke on the hills above Mitsiwa. I go to meet him there," he explained.
"I've heard that the emperor has won a great victory over the pagan at Mitsiwa," Hal prompted him.
"Oh, a great and wonderful victory," Phasilides enthused. "In the Easter season, the pagan drove northwards up the coast, seizing all the ports and forts. Our emperor's father fell in battle.
and much of our army was scattered and destroyed.
Then, when the pagan arrayed 100,000 men before Mitziwa, it seemed that God had forsaken Ethiopia.
Phasilides' eyes filled with tears.
But he is the one God, and true to his people.
And he sent us a warrior to lead our shattered army.
Nazet came down from the mountains, bringing the army of the Amhara to join our forces here on the coast, and bearing in the vanguard the sacred tabernacle of Mary, Mother of God. Before its advance, the pagan was hurled back in confusion.
What is this talisman you speak of, Your Grace? Is it a sacred relic? The bishop reached across the table to grip Hal's hand and stare into his eyes.
It is a relic of Jesus Christ, the most powerful in all Christendom.
Hal felt his skin crawl with religious awe.
The tabernacle of Mary contains the cup of life, the holy grail that Christ used at the Last Supper, the same chalice in which Joseph of Arimathea collected the blood of the Savior as he hung upon the cross.
Where is this holy thing? Hal's voice rose with excitement. The chivalric order of which I am a knight is based upon this fabulous cup. Where may I find it, and worship before it?
Phasilides seemed to sober at Hal's excitement. There are things which cannot be disclosed.
Once again he became remote and unapproachable. Hal realized that it would be unwise to pursue the subject further. The shattered remnants of the Emperor Yasu's fleet lay off Mitziwa. Hal anchored well clear of these burned and battered hulks, and Phasilides sent one of his servants ashore in the longboat.
He will find out if Nazet's headquarters are still at the monastery. And if they are, we must arrange horses for us to travel there.
Hal fretted out the rest of that day and night, but at first light the masthead hailed the deck,
"Small dhow coming out from the bay!"
Hal hurried on deck. Even without his telescope, he recognized Phasilides' servant standing on the open deck of the small craft. Phasilides and the servant spoke rapidly in the Gies language. He turned to Hal.
The Emperor and General Nazet are still at the monastery. Horses are waiting for us on the beach. We can be there by noon. My servant has brought clothing for you and your servant that will make you less conspicuous.
When he and Abeli came back on deck, the crew gawked at them, and Phasilides nodded approval.
Now none will recognize you as a Frank.
Although the battle had taken place weeks before, the carrion birds hovered over the battlefield like a dark cloud, and the jackals snarled over piles of bones.
10,000 enemy dead, Phasilides said triumphantly,
and led them on a track that left the battlefield and skirted the walled town of Mitziwa. Beyond the town, the victorious army of Emperor Yasu was encamped. It was a city of leather tents and hastily built huts that stretched 5 leagues from the sea to the hills. They passed squadrons of cavalry on magnificent chargers, and regiments of foot soldiers that marched and countermarched.
60,000 men, said Phasilides. With the tabernacle and Nazet at their head, no enemy can stand before them.
The monastery of St. Luke clung to a rugged hilltop. Abeli and Hal found themselves in a small shrine off the nave of the main chapel.
Wait here, Phasilides said.
He went to the vividly coloured wall hanging behind the altar and drew it aside to reveal a narrow doorway. Then he stooped through the opening and disappeared. Time stretched out, and suddenly a small boy appeared from under the curtain and skidded to a halt on the paving. He was 4 or 5 years of age. The boy said something in Gies. It was obviously a request, but Hal could not even guess at the substance of it. The boy stared into his eyes, then spoke again, pointing passionately at Hal's face.
I cannot understand what you're saying, little one, Hal said gently.
Phasilides had come up silently behind him and now said solemnly,
His Most Christian Majesty, Yasu, King of Kings, remarks that your eyes are of a strange green colour
unlike any he has seen before. Hal stared into the angelic features of the imp. This is the Prester John?
Indeed, replied the bishop.
Suddenly, Yazoo seized Hal's hand and dragged him through the concealed doorway into a long chamber. A table ran the length of the chamber, and seated at it were five warriors. At the far end stood the youngest and most commanding of all. "Are you General Nazet?" Hal asked in Latin.
"I am indeed General Nazet."
His voice was low and husky, strangely musical to the ear. Hal realized with a shock how young he was. "I am Henry Courtenay," said Hal, "the English captain of the Golden Bough."
"Bishop Thassilides has told me this," said the general in English. "My Latin is not as fluent as yours, captain."
"You astound me, general," Hal admitted, and while he gathered his wits, he noticed that Nazet's eyes were the color of honey, and his lashes long, thick, and curled. Hal had never felt sexually attracted to another male before. Now, however, as he stared into Nazet's lustrous eyes, he became aware of a pressure in his chest that made it difficult for him to draw the next breath.
"Please be seated, captain."
Nazet indicated the stool beside him.
"You have arrived at a most propitious time. As Thassilides told you of the defeat that our navy suffered at Adulis Bay."
"He has told me of your magnificent victory at Mitsiwa."
"The one counterbalances the other. If El Gran commands the sea, he can bring in endless reinforcements and stores from Arabia and the territory of the Mogul. Every day he grows stronger. Now a new menace besets me. El Gran has taken into his service a foreign ship of the frigate class."
"Do you know the name of the captain?" Hal demanded.
"Only that he is inflicting terrible losses on our transport dhows."
"What flag does he fly?" Hal persisted.
"This ship flies the pennant of Omani, but also a red cross of unusual shape on a ground."
"I think I know this marauder," said Hal grimly, "and I will pit my vessel against his at the first opportunity, if his most Christian majesty will grant me a commission."
"I have already ordered the court scribes to draw up your commission."
Nazet stroked the little emperor's head, and Hal stared at the hand. It was slim and smooth and dainty, with long, tapered fingers. Suddenly the truth dawned on him, and he blurted out in English,
"Mother Mary, you're a woman!"
Nazet's amber cheeks darkened with annoyance.
"I advise you not to disparage me on account of my gender, captain." "As an Englishman, you might remember the military lessons a woman handed out to you at Orléans."
"I meant no offense, General. It only enhances the admiration I had already conceived for your powers of leadership." Nazet was not so easily mollified.
"I will expect you to place yourself under my direct command, and as to your share of the prize money, 2/3 will accrue to the Imperial Exchequer, and the balance to you and your crew. Now, Bishop Thassilides will see you to where your horses are waiting. Farewell, Captain."
Colonel Cornelius Scrowder dismounted in front of the tent of shimmering red and yellow silk which stood on a small knoll overlooking Adulis Bay. The bay was crowded with shipping, but the masts of the Gull of Moray dominated all others. Within, the great Mogul's brother, the Maharaj Sadiq Khan Jahan, sat on a pile of silk cushions. On one gloved hand he held a falcon. A little behind him sat Ahmed Grang, the left hand of Allah. His eyes were as cold and implacable as those of an eagle. Behind this pair sat a host of courtiers and officers. Before the prince knelt a translator, who was trying to keep up with the buzzard's flood of invective. Scrowder made a deep and respectful obeisance, first to the prince, and then to El Grang.
"Jesus love you, Colonel," said the buzzard. "I need you to talk some sense into these laddies. Do you want me to do battle with the Golden Bough, which has arrived in these waters and is whaling into El Grana's transports? No Mussulman captains will put to sea while he's in the offing, so the entire fleet of Allah, the All-Merciful, is bottled up in port, and they're calling young Courtney El Tazar the Barracuda."
"What do you want me to tell His Highness?" Scrowder asked scornfully. "That you're afraid to meet young Courtney?"
"I'm afraid of no man living.
But there's no profit in it for me. Hal Courtney's nothing I want. But if it comes to a single ship fight, he could do me and my gull fearful damage. If they want me to fight with him, they will have to sweeten my cup a little."
Scrowder explained this to the prince in diplomatic terms. And the prince said to Scrowder, "Ask this noble bird of prey what payment he demands for fighting Eltazar."
"Tell the pretty boy I want a lakh of rupees in gold coin and in my hands before I leave port."
"The prince says that you could build 20 ships like the gull for a lakh."
"Well, that may be so, but it won't buy me a pair of balls to replace the ones that Hal Courtney shoots away."
The prince smiled.
"Tell the buzzard he must have lost him long ago, but he makes a fine eunuch. I could always find a place for him in my harem."
The buzzard guffawed at the insult.
"Tell that pretty pederast no gold and the buzzard flies away."
The prince and Elgrang whispered to each other.
"I have another proposition that the bold captain might find more to his taste. The risk will not be so great, but he will receive the lakh he demands. Elgrang will explain this to you in secrecy."
Hal was the first to see the three Chinese rockets soar up into the sky. It was a signal from Judith Nazet, an urgent recall. It was fully light as they nosed in towards the shore. From two cables' length away, he recognized the slim figure in the boat that came to meet him. Judith Nazet came through the entry port with a lithe and graceful urgency. "A terrible catastrophe has taken us. The Emperor and the Tabernacle have both been stolen. Two of the priests were able to follow the blasphemers who rode directly to Tenwera. There was a great ship waiting for them, the one we spoke of at our first meeting."
"The buzzard!" Hal exclaimed.
"He will have been ordered to take Iazu to Muscat, or even to India. We must follow at once." He called urgently to Ned Tyler. "Bring her around and set every yard of canvas you can cram onto her. Course is south-southeast for the Bab el Mandeb." He took Judith's arm, the first time he had ever touched her, and led her down to his cabin. "You're weary," he said. "I can see it in your eyes."
"No,"
she said. "It is not weariness you see, but sorrow.
If you cannot save us, then all is lost. A king, a country, the faith.
If we can reach the Bab el Mandab before he does, then he cannot avoid us," Hal said.
"God grant it," Judith prayed.
"But you cannot fire upon his ship. He has the Emperor and the Tabernacle on board with him. You cannot risk destroying either of those."
Night came upon them as stealthily as an assassin, and in the darkness he felt Judith's hand on his arm.
"Deck!"
Abelie's voice boomed out of the darkness high above.
"A light! Dead ahead!"
Hal placed one arm around Judith's shoulders, and she made no move to pull it away from him. "I must go aloft." He strode across to Ned. "Dark ship, Mr. Tyler. Silent ship. No sound of voice." Hal climbed swiftly until he had joined Abelie. "Where is this light?"
"It has gone, but it was almost dead ahead."
Suddenly Hal saw it, a soft luminescence, so nebulous that he doubted his eyes. He and Abelie stayed together, peering into the night.
"We're gaining,"
Hal whispered, feeling a sense of religious dread as he stared at the light in the gull's stern where none should be.
"Abelie, 'tis the Tabernacle of Mary that glows in the darkness, a beacon to guide me to my destiny."
Hal's voice was serene. "God has given me a sign." They climbed down to the deck, and Hal went towards the bows. Slowly, achingly slowly, they closed the gap. Suddenly there came a wild scream of terror from the gull's masthead.
"Sail ho! Dead astern! The golden bough!"
The gull's battle lanterns flared as she lit up to give her gunners light to work. Then her silhouette altered rapidly as she came around. Ned had already given the order to shorten to fighting sail when Hal's eyeballs were seared by the brilliant crimson glow as the gull fired her broadside into the golden bow at point-blank range. The terrible silence that followed the thunder of the broadside was marred only by the screams and groans of the wounded and the dying. Then, before any more of the gull's guns could be run out, the ships came together with a rending crash. Hal sprang to the gunwale and leaped across the narrow strip of water as the two hulls surged alongside each other. He landed lightly as a cat among the nearest of the Buzzard's gun crews and killed two men before they could draw their cutlasses. A wave of his boarders followed him over her side, and within seconds the gull's upper deck was transformed into a battlefield. At that moment, a battle lantern came crashing to the deck at Hal's feet. He sprang back from the blaze of burning oil that roared up into his face, and then leapt through the flames to reach the Buzzard. But the Earl of Cambrai had disappeared. He saw Judith Narset, followed closely by Big Daniel, carrying the tabernacle of Mary. The golden angels on its lid sparkled in the light of the flames.
"Yazoo!" she shouted. "He is gone!"
"Go with Daniel. Take the tabernacle to safety on the golden bough. I will find him." She neither argued nor hesitated, but ran as a phalanx of Abeli's Amadoda warrior seamen swept across the deck. The gull's sailors scattered before that rush of howling, prancing warriors. The Buzzard's men were beaten. At that moment, a bellow stopped Hal dead. The Buzzard stood on high, lit by flames.
"Courtney!" he roared. "Is this what you're searching for?"
In his right hand he held his claymore, and in his left he carried Yazoo. The child was screaming with terror. With a sweep of his thick, hairy arm, the Buzzard threw the child 15 feet straight up in the air, and then held the point of the claymore beneath him as he dropped. At the last instant, before the child was impaled on the point, he flicked aside the sword, and Yazoo fell back, unscathed, into his grasp.
"Parley!" Hal shouted. "Give me the child unharmed, and you can go free with all your booty. My ship is burned, and my booty with it. But you shall have what you ask, there!"
With a mighty swing of his arm, he hurled Yazoo far out over the ship's side. With only a soft splash, the dark waters swallowed him. Hal dropped his sword, and with 3 running strides reached the rail and dived over the side. Looking up from 20 feet deep, the water was clear as mountain air. He could see the reflection of the flames from the burning ship dancing on the surface ripple. Then he saw a small, dark shape. He reached him before he was whirled away. Holding him to his chest, he shot to the surface. Yazoo struggled feebly, coughing and choking.
"Blow it all out of you," said Hal, and looked around.
Big Daniel must have recalled his men, then cut the grappling lines to get the golden bough away from the burning hull. The 2 ships were drifting apart. The Buzzard still stood alone on the break of the forecastle. His beard began to smoke and blacken, but he looked down at Hal and choked with laughter. Then the flames leapt high, and the stricken gull bore away her master on the wind. A freak wave lifted Hal and the child high. The gull blew up with a devastating roar, and, as Hal watched, burning timbers were hurled high into the night sky, then fell to quench themselves in the rippling waters. Darkness and silence descended. Back aboard the Golden Bough, Hal looked around the grinning faces of his crew.
"Well, you ruffians paid out the Buzzard and his cutthroats in a heavier coin than they bargained for. Mr. Tyler, break out the rum barrel, and give a double ration to every hand aboard to toast the Buzzard on his way to hell."
He carried the little Emperor, suddenly and profoundly asleep, down to the stern cabin. He laid him on the bunk, and turned to Judith, who stood close beside him. "He is a sturdy lad, and has come to little harm. We should let him sleep."
"Yes," she said quietly.
Without looking at him, she led him out of the main cabin to the small adjoining one, closed the door, and bolted it.
"Your clothes are wet," she said,
and, like a handmaiden, began to undress him.
Then, standing before him, she began to undress. Beneath the warlike garb, her skin was a translucent amber. Her breasts were small, but the nipples were hard, round and dark, red as ripe berries. Her lean hips were sculpted into the sweet sweep of her waist. At last she came to him and kissed deep into his mouth. Then she gave an urgent little cry, and they fell onto the bunk. He was astonished by the strength and suppleness of her body as he reached up and cleaved to her. Reverently, Daniel Fisher placed the tabernacle of Mary on the longboat's floorboards. Judith Narzet, in armor and war helmet, stood in the bows, holding the hand of the little boy beside her. Hal took the tiller, and 10 seamen rowed them through towards the beach. Bishop Fasilides and 50 war captains waited for them on the sands. 10,000 warriors lined the cliffs above. As they recognized their general and their monarch, they began to cheer, and the cheering swept away across the plain until it was carried by 50,000 voices to echo along the desert hills. Judith Narzet mounted her black stallion and urged him, rearing and prancing, to where Hal stood at the water's edge. "If the battle goes with us, the pagan will try to escape by sea. Visit the wrath of Almighty God upon him with your fair ship," she ordered. "If the battle goes against us, have the golden bow waiting to take the emperor to safety."
"I will be waiting here for you, General Narzet."
Hal tried to give the words a special emphasis. Her eyes were dark and bright behind the steel nosepiece of her helmet. "I will wish all the days of my life that it could have been otherwise, Eltazar." She wheeled the stallion away and went up the cliff path. The golden bow put out to sea, and when they were beyond the 50-fathom line, they committed their dead to the sea. There were 43 in those canvas shrouds, men of Wales and Devon and the mysterious lands along the Zambia River, all comrades now forever. Then Hal ran the ship back into the shallow, protected waters, where he put every man to work repairing the battle damage. On the third morning, he woke to the sound of the guns. Abelly was standing by the lee rail.
"It has begun, Gondwani. The general has pitted her army against El Grang in the final battle."
It was past noon when the Golden Bough took up her station and shortened sail. Slowly the battle rolled towards the shoreline, and Hal saw a charger of cavalry sweep along the top of the cliffs and tear into a loose, untidy formation of infantry. The sabres rose and fell, and the foot soldiers scattered before them. Men hurled themselves into the sea below.
"Narzet has beaten them," said Abole.
The Golden Bough glided silently into the mouth of the bay. A motley armada of dhows of every size and condition, packed with fugitives, set out from the beach around the blazing port of Zula towards the opening of the bay. The Golden Bough ploughed into this vast fleet, and her guns began to thunder. One after the other, they were shattered and capsized, their cargoes of exhausted, defeated troops hurled into the water. Their armor bore them down swiftly. It was such a terrible massacre that the gunners no longer cheered as they ran out the guns, but served them in grim silence. Hal also was sickened by the slaughter and longed for any chance to cease the carnage. That opportunity came from an unlooked-for direction. Abelly pointed out over the starboard bow.
"That ship with the red sail, the man in the stern, do you see him, Gondwani?"
Hal felt the prickle of apprehension on his arms, and the cold sweat sliding down his back as he recognized the tall figure leaning back against the tiller arm. He wore a turban of yellow and the heavily embroidered dolman of an Islamic grandee over baggy white breeches and soft knee-high boots, but his pale face stood out like a mirror among the dark-bearded men around him.
"Bring the ship about, Mr. Tyler. Heave to alongside that dhow with a red sail," Hal ordered.
Scrowder stood alone in the stern and looked up at the frigate with his cold, unrelenting expression. They were so close that Hal had hardly to raise his voice to make himself heard.
"Colonel Scrowder, sir, you have my sword."
Then, sir, would you care to come down and take it from me?
Scrowder asked. Mr. Tyler, you have the con in my absence. Take me closer to the dhow so that I may board her. He drew his sword and looked to the stern. Scrowder stepped away from the tiller bar and shrugged out of the stiff dolman tunic.
You are a romantic fool, Henry Courtenay, he murmured, and the blade of the Neptune sword whispered softly from its scabbard.
To the death? Hal asked as he drew his own blade.
Naturally, for I am going to kill you.
They came together with the slow grace of two lovers beginning a minuet. Their blades met and flirted as they circled, tap and brush, a slither of steel on steel, their feet never still, points held high and eyes locked.
An eye for his eyes.
Hal seemed to hear his father's voice in his head.
Read in them his soul.
Scrowder's face remained grave, but Hal saw the first shadow in his cold blue eyes. Even with these light touches of their blades, Scrowder had evaluated his man, and Hal knew that if he lived through this, he would never again dance so close to death and smell its breath as he did now. They backed and circled, both men bleeding now, and Hal felt the warm wetness soaking through the front of his shirt, and a scarlet snake ran slowly down past the corner of Scrowder's thin lips and dripped from his chin.
First blood was mine, I think, sir, Scrowder asked.
It was, sir, Hal conceded. But whose will be the last? And the words were not past his lips before Scrowder attacked in earnest, while the watchers on the golden bow howled and danced with excitement. He drove Hal from the stern to the bow and pinned him there with their blades locked and forced his back against the gunwale. Deliberately, Hal swayed backward, but his back was loaded like a longbow taking the weight of the archer's draw. He unleashed, and with the strength of his legs, arms, and upper body, hurled Scrowder backwards. Hal went on the attack, and he forced Scrowder back to the stern, the tiller arm digging into his spine. Their swords swirled and shrilled together, a silver whirlpool of molten sunlight that held them apart, yet locked them together. On it went, and on. The sweat streamed down both their faces, and their breath came in short, urgent grunts. It was death to the first man to break. Then Hal felt the first weakness in Scrowder's sword arm, and saw the despair in his eyes. Then Scrowder broke, and Hal was on him. He hit him hard in the center of his chest, and felt the point go home, strike bone, and the hilt thrill in his hand. The roar from the men on the deck of the frigate broke over them like a wave of storm-driven surf, and Scrowder fell to the deck. Painfully, Hal went down on one knee beside his body. He prized open Scrowder's dead fingers from the hilt of the Neptune sword, and with it in his own hand rose to face the towering deck of the Golden Bow. He held the gleaming sword high, and they cheered him wildly. He felt, but did not see, the frigate bump against the dhow, as Ned Tyler brought her alongside, and then Abberley's hands were on his shoulders, and his voice was deep and close as he lifted Hal in his arms.
It is over now, Gondwani. All of it is done.
15 days later, Ned Tyler came to him.
Ship is ready for sea, Captain.
Thank you, Mr. Tyler. Hal turned from him and left him standing without orders. There came a hail from the masthead.
There's a boat putting out from the port.
Eagerly, Hal strode back to the rail. He felt the lead of disappointment weight his limbs when he recognized only Bishop Fasilides' lanky frame. Fasilides came in through the entry port and made the sign of the cross.
Bless this fine ship and all the brave men who sail in her.
I come as a messenger from the Emperor. I bring his greetings and his thanks to you and your men.
He turned to one of the priests who followed him and took from him the heavy gold chain he carried.
On the Emperor's behalf, I bestow upon you the Order of the Golden Lion of Ethiopia, and I bring with me the prize monies that you have earned from your gallant war upon the Pagan, together with the reward that the Emperor personally sends you.
From the dhow, they brought up 4 wooden chests.
Vasilides lifted the lid of one, and the sparkle of gold within was dazzling in the sunlight.
"Well, my lads," Hal called to his men, "you'll have the price of a flagon of beer in your purse when next we dock in Plymouth Harbour."
"When will you sail?" Vasilides wanted to know. "All is in readiness," Hal replied. "But tell me, what news of Judith Nazet?" Vasilides looked at him shrewdly. "No news. After the coronation she disappeared, and the tabernacle of Mary with her. Some say she has gone back into the mountains when she came." Hal's face darkened.
"I will sail on tomorrow morning's tide, Father, and I thank you and the Emperor for your charity and your blessings."
The following morning, as Hal made his final tour of inspection of the ship, he steadfastly refrained from looking back towards the shore.
"Up anchor, Mr. Tyler. Set all plain sail. Take us south to Elephant Lagoon. We have some unfinished business thereabouts."
Ned Tyler and Big Daniel grinned at the prospect of reclaiming their share of the treasure that they knew was hidden there. The canvas billowed out from her yards, and the Golden Bough shook herself and came awake.
"Dick!" The hail from the lookout rang out of the lightning sky. "Signal from the shore!"
Hal turned quickly. Above the walls of Zula, three bright red lights hung in the dawn sky, and as he watched, they floated gracefully back to Earth.
"Three Chinese rockets," Aboli said. "The recall signal."
"Put the ship about, please, Mr. Tyler," said Hal,
and went to the rail as the ship swung round.
"Boat putting out from the port," came Aboli's hail.
Hal peered ahead, and out of the gloom saw the shape of a small dhow coming to meet them. As the range closed, he felt his heart leap, and his breath came shorter. In the bows stood a woman, who wore a blue kaftan and a headcloth of the same colour. As the boat drew alongside, she lifted the cloth from her head, and Hal saw the glorious dark crown of her hair. When Judith Nazet stepped onto the deck, he greeted her awkwardly.
"Good morrow, General Nazet.
I am a general no longer. Now I am only a common maid named Judith. I came as soon as I was able."
Her voice was husky and uncertain.
"Now at last Yazoo is crowned, and the tabernacle has gone back to its resting place in the mountains."
"I had despair of you," he said.
"No, Eltazar, never do that," she answered him.
With surprise, Hal saw that the dhow was already on its way back to the shore. It had unloaded no baggage.
"You have brought nothing with you?" he asked.
"Only my heart," she replied softly.
"I'm southward bound," he said.
"Wherever you go, my lord, I go also."
As the Golden Bough ran out to meet the dawn, Hal stood tall on the quarter-deck, his left hand resting lightly on the sapphire and the pommel of the Neptune sword. With his other arm, he reached out and drew Judith Nazet closer to him. She came willingly.